The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It's 7:31 this morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. We're here with you until 9:30 this morning. If there's anything you'd like to get off your chest, you can tweet us using the hashtag OTBAM, or you can leave a comment on whatever stream you're watching. If you're watching this on Facebook, or if you're watching this on YouTube, or indeed if you're watching this on Periscope, we're monitoring all those. And we're going to be getting you a WhatsApp number to get involved with in the next couple of days as well, that we'll start putting up and publicising for you as well. If you want that, if that is how you want to get involved in the conversation. We're going to talk about Villa last night. We're going to talk, well, I suppose it's really Leicester and Villa. We're going to talk about the FAI. We're going to talk about Jack McCaffrey. We're going to talk about everything else that's happening in the world of sport with a rugby hit as well, where myself and Owen are going to pick the Ireland teams that we would pick for the Six Nations.
The reason why we earned Ireland head coach slot is what we're calling it.
Yeah, exactly. Before we get to all that, though, the big story overnight is that we now know the identity of three of the independent directors. There was a little bit of... I had a query whether or not there was going to be four independent directors and an independent chair, but in total it's going to be four. So the independent chair has been appointed and is getting into business pretty quickly. This was the person that we thought it was going to be, who comes from a stockbroking background. We're going to get the full details on who he is from Vincent Wall, the group business editor here, a little bit later on, to just explain exactly what his background would be and what he's going to bring to it. But the other two have got interesting and diverse backgrounds as well.
Like the, a human resources element to it. There's, you've got Liz Joyce and Catherine Guy, who are the other two appointed members to independent directors, alongside Roy Barrett, who, as we knew yesterday, was going to be the independent chairman. And there's a number of different strands to both of them. And I think the front of the Irish Times this morning, the line about Catherine Guy that really stands out is that her parents would have taken the sample of Michelle Smith back in the day, the famous sample, of course. And that's just something that kind of sticks out as well. That's an interesting tidbit. But the reason why they were appointed, obviously, is because of their business acumen and their association with, like, an unbelievable CV that they both have, and something that would probably go down well in any organisation in Ireland, let alone a sporting organisation. Like, I'd be very interested to hear exactly how hands-on they're going to be and for how long they're going to be that hands-on for. We'll get more detail, as you say, from Vincent a little bit later on.
Yeah, so Catherine Guy is a former managing partner at the legal firm Byrne Wallace. She's the chief executive of Sixt Leasing, which is the car leasing company. So obviously there's a legal background and a business background straight away that you understand is going to be very useful to an organisation which is ravaged the way the FAI is. And the other appointment is Liz Joyce, whose background was in HR. And Liz Joyce was initially involved, I think, with Concern in their HR department, moved from there and then ended up at the central bank. So again, at the central bank in HR, there is a huge governance aspect to it, because, you know, you're dealing with the financial policy and the running of how the banks are supposed to run. And that's, you know, there are rules and regulations around that. There is a lot of red tape. And so that's somebody who obviously comes in understanding exactly the type of candidate required in a business and in an organization to be able to deal with all of the different things that you have to deal with when you're going to be in the FAI. Now, what's interesting is that there's speculation from the Irish Times this morning that Niall Quinn has been tapped to be at least an interim CEO by the new independent chair, because there's a connection there in the past. It's believed Quinn is reluctant to become the chief executive, that he wants to do something in a voluntary role.
Like, I guess there's kind of two different elements to it. First of all, you've got the Niall Quinn element to it, which we've been speaking about for years, really, that even before things started to get a little bit messy for the FAI in March last year, there was always talk about a clear out of the FAI needs to be done, Niall Quinn needs to be installed. So this isn't anything new, really, but then this is given kind of a concrete base because of Roy Barrett, who's got a close relationship with Niall Quinn, by all accounts, was cited in one of Niall Quinn's recent reports, and they've been closely aligned, and I think Barrett will be well behind the idea of Niall Quinn coming in. So this is what comes back to the question, like, how long in the ideal world would these independent directors last for? How long would the project be? And does Niall Quinn just be part of this temporary solution that will actually set the groundwork for a permanent solution, you'd like to hope? But maybe his views change a little bit. Like, I'm sure 12 months ago, Niall Quinn was saying to himself, God, I'd never would want to be involved with that basket case of an association. And maybe that is kind of the view that is out there at the moment. You'd like to think that, or you'd suspect that has probably changed over recent months, or certainly over recent weeks, when things have started to look a little bit more hopeful, especially with the pace that things have started to get cleared out of the FAI.
Yeah, look, I think that you've got to sound cautionary notes about all this stuff because of the number of different investigations that are ongoing at the moment into the FAI, and because of the absolute difficulties that they're going to face raising money, that there will be job losses, that you know, the sponsorship deals are all kind of coming to an end. So a lot of stuff has to happen for this to be turned around, but at least you have competent people with a diverse background who are coming in with a bit of wind in their sails in terms of there's a desire within the organisation for change, there's a desire outside the organisation for change, and now you actually have the government in a position where if a deal is done, they're going to be the ones who are forcing things along, and UEFA have no choice but to accept the fact that either this organisation goes bust and UEFA pays for it, or the Irish government and the Irish people guarantee it and we help the organisation to trade out of its difficulties.
Like, I'm sure it's been spoken about and it has been mentioned, this whole policy that UEFA have of no government interference allowed. Like, is that going to come back in the end and UEFA are going to give the FAI a stern telling off? You suspect the answer to that question is very much no, because as you say, they haven't had to inject as much money as the Irish government may have to inject.
Well, they have at the moment. They're on the hook for more money than the government are.
At the moment, they are.
Yeah, so like they probably do have a right to say, but I think obviously it's like good money after bad, or are you looking for a partner in this? And so everybody kind of steps in. And, you know, UEFA can't be looking at this and going, oh, this is perfectly well run. Yeah. You know, you don't need any outside influence here.
But the UEFA money is obviously future earnings. Like, it is stuff that... It is cash that the FAI would say that they had an entitlement to earn one day or another. But drawing down those funds as early as they've done is obviously a disaster.
Look, it's not great business practice,
no,
is it?
It's not.
How are you living for today? And what are you going to do at that point?
Maybe everybody in the FAI just really believed that the world was indeed going to end due to global warming in like 2 years. So, like, doesn't matter. Just take the money now. Just inject the cash right now.
All right, let's tell you what's coming up on the show today. Going to bring in sports headlines now in just a minute. The FAI director has a bit more detail on that. Vincent Ball is going to join us at 7:45. Top five stories of the day. Going to hear from Declan Bonner, who's saying that he might not be able to field a team in the pre-season competition this weekend, given that so many of his players are playing Sigerson. Irish rugby 23s. We picked full 23s, our replacements as well. The ego on that. Sports news at 8:35 from Tom Malone. Stephen Kelly's going to join us in studio around about 8:45. And to, you know, parse through exactly what Spurs need to be doing at the moment in the transfer window and how well or otherwise Jose Mourinho has started. And then Deal or No Deal is coming your way at 9:15. If you have any transfer gossip that you'd like us to address and put to the oracle that is Phil, then get it to us now. You can use the hashtag OTBAM. I'm going to bring you through.
OTBAM.
So, it's never great when you're starting with the front page. It's front of the Irish Times, small headline there. And it is beside the plane crash in Tehran. FAI chair to tackle significant failures. So that's the Jack Horgan-Jones story. Roy Barrett said there is a serious job of work to be done to address the very significant failures which have beset the organisation in terms of its governance and its finances. The new board will now deal with this task with urgency, working collaboratively with stakeholders. And so just you want to make sure that those stakeholders do include, obviously, the grassroots of football. Sorry, I should do the sports pages, shouldn't I, as well?
While you're doing that, I'll have a look at the back page of the Irish Daily Mail. Andy's dilemma. Farrell is feeling the early heat with the loss of Joey Carberry. Confirmed yesterday that Joey Carberry could be out for up to 4 months. McCaffrey backs McShane's Aussie switch, meanwhile, and Iheanacho to the rescue. Leicester won, Aston Villa won in the Carabao Cup semi-final first leg last night.
Munster hoping Hanrahan ready for Paris as Carberry suffers setback. And there's a picture of Graham Rowntree at training as well. Pro 14 player rotation could give provinces boost over French teams. You know, that's Sean Sullivan's column there. It's knockout, it's massive, it's huge, but that's European rugby. This is the Johan van Graan chat. And then McCaffrey looking forward to new chapter under Farrell. And he says Cluxton is gung-ho to play again. So, does that change things?
Change things that he's going... No, because he was always going back.
Do you think so?
The first time when my confidence wavered yesterday was when I picked up the newspaper and I saw Tommy Carr saying, yes, I suspect he is coming back. Then I realised it was actually up for debate. Tab of the morning to you. Back page of the Irish Daily Star. Harry and Began, Solskjaer to plead for transfer funds after Maguire is ruled out for 2 months. Barrett to lead the FAI, as we've already mentioned. Cluxton gung-ho to play on. And Nacho to the rescue for the Foxes.
The back page of the Irish Independent this morning is Murray can rise to Racing challenge Van Grant. So I suppose we've been focused all week really on the issues around the 10 position for Munster, but I guess if your 9 isn't playing as well as you want him to, then you'd be a bit concerned about that too.
For sure, especially if somebody like Ben Healy is going to be installed at number 10. You'd imagine that it's hugely important for a starting out half to have someone beside him who's in a decent run of form.
So, is starting Ben Healy actually the best course of action when you think about it, right? Because Hanrahan is coming back off an injury, has had no game time, fully fit. Mm. It's a hamstring injury. We know hamstring injuries are different on a case-by-case basis. But generally, there's a lack of confidence straight away on a hamstring until you've built yourself back up to full speed and full pace. Is that the scenario you want your 10 going into a game in Paris in? Do you want somebody who hasn't played 10, really, who's a centre, playing 10? Or do you want somebody who's a 10, who's like, come on, put me in, coach. You said you were in a YouTube wormhole this morning.
Yeah, I was watching a bit of Ben Healy at last year's under 20 World Cup.
How did it go for Ben Healy?
Yeah, it went very well.
At the under 20 World Cup.
You had Aussies or Kiwis, I couldn't really decipher the accent, going crazy in the commentary saying.
A bit racist.
It is, completely, totally. I'm a complete bigot when it comes to those two countries in particular. Just completely glorifying Ben Healy and what a World Cup he was having. Played a beautiful reverse pass, I think it was against Italy. Again, you know, it was a blue jersey. It could have been Italy or it could have been France. Again, once again, getting into this wormhole of not being able to decipher. But he looked amazing. Just his ability with the ball in his hand is exceptional. And I know you're judging it at literally underage rugby, and it's a totally different level. But the reason why you're a star at underage level is, and why we get so excited about these players, is that they will one day become senior stars. You will have to make your debut at some stage. And, like, Is there more of an expectancy for you to shoot the lights out when you're at home to Ospreys in Irish Independent Park, for example?
Yeah, there is.
Then you are land defensive.
And who are you going to be playing with in that game?
There you go.
You know, it's not guaranteed that you're going to be playing with the first team. This is your chance to step in and be in the first team. And also, if you're the coach and you're currently getting a little bit of heat from a lot of different angles, which gives you the best? Look, we put a young guy out and we gave him every opportunity and we backed him. It didn't work out, but we're going to keep backing him because he's our guy. I'd be more inclined to go, yeah, come on. No?
It
buys you time. It buys you, and everybody gets excited about it.
And when you come off the back of the pitch and if you get beaten, the narrative is, well, what did you make of Ben Healy's performance? And Van Grant can say, well, I was actually quite encouraged by his performance. Fortunately, things didn't work out for him today. I know I'm putting a lot of words in mouths here for an event that hasn't even happened yet.
Now,
but that's how these things tend to happen.
The flip side of that is the Ireland-England game in Twickenham before the Rugby World Cup where
someone gets shattered.
Yeah, well, I got to think, right, clearly Ross Byrne was not shattered. He would have been just fine after that because he could have said, well, I mean, the forwards were not really there today. The paper-thin effort's the wrong word. The paper-thin achievement of that forward pack against that England pack kind of left me in a bit of a dodgy scenario here. So, you know, maybe if give me a platform, I'm going to play well, which he's proven ever since. So the confidence thing is this will be a major setback for him for months and months and months. Well, no, it won't. Next time you play, stick him against the Ospreys in Independent Park. Let him run a game and he's going to be fine.
Yeah, I'm not sure, was it you kind of making the comparison to a green bar of energy? It was with Killian Clark the other day with regards to fitness. I think the same thing kind of works with confidence, as in it's not a green bar of confidence that you kind of slowly top up. It can be sub-zero after getting hammered, and then the next day in a game away from all the fanfare and you play well, suddenly it's right up near the top again. One thing can completely flip things when it comes to confidence, I would have thought. So yeah, I'd be on board for that. Over the last couple of days, I'm starting to think that actually starting this kid at 10 in this big game at the weekend is a brave but correct course of action.
Well, it totally depends on the fitness. We're not getting hour-by-hour updates on JJ Hanrahan. And if he's totally fine, if he's running full pace and it's absolutely fine, then go for it. But sticking Scannell in and not giving the kid the chance to play when actually maybe Scannell is your best option at centre. And then, you're actually giving somebody who we think has the potential to be a superstar the opportunity to be a superstar. And I think everybody would get behind that. So there you go. I don't think anybody should criticise Van Grant if he picks Healy at the weekend and goes, yeah, we're going for him. And this is all them slowly building up to it. Front page there. In at the deep end, Van Grant backs tip Tyro Healy to do something great. So obviously in the press conference, that's exactly what you're going to say. But the fact that they're talking about it, I think you would hope they're leaning towards it.
Mm-hmm. He does look particularly young as well for a young fella. You're never in doubt as to whether or not he's a young fella stepping up to the mantle. But like, I'm all for it. I think it just makes for a more spectacular front page or back page, say, on Monday morning after Munster have done the business in Paris.
Yeah, I think that's what sport is about. If he gets that opportunity, that's just the way sport works. It's an opportunity for somebody to do something great. We took him to the Ospreys game in round one to get the feel of the squad, and he was in the warm-up in every game. Then starting the game against Edinburgh, he was in the Connacht 23, but JJ just played so well, and it was tight in the back end, so we didn't put him on. So, there, you know, sometimes there's a phrase, you're only one injury away from having a great team. Like, maybe this guy is actually their best out half, and that's exactly what they need. Get him in, get him 15 games this season. Next year, he's just starting 10. Joey Carberry can go back to fullback, and away we go.
I was wondering where that sentence was going to go. I was wondering whether you were going to say fullback or Leinster at that point. Back page of the Sun, it says out for Harry Maguire. Another United blow. He's ruled out for a month. Fed up gaffer. Ole meanwhile ready to axe flop Jesse after gutless City performance. And Joey Carberry out, you'd imagine, for the duration of the Six Nations. And still in with a shout is their headline on Leicester 1, Aston Villa 1.
Big controversy brewing in English racing at the moment. The front page headline on the Racing Post is BHA vet to examine Altior after Henderson fails to scratch star from Kempton. The BHA, British Horse Racing Authority, has revealed that Altior has yet to be scratched from Saturday's Sylvian Acquaconti chase at Kempton and called on trainer Nicky Henderson to clarify Altior's participation in the interests of fairness and transparency. In a statement last night, the authority said it would be sending a vet to Henderson's Seven Barrows Yard today to examine the two-time champion chase winner. Henderson had tweeted on Tuesday the star chaser would not run on Saturday, with the trainer expanding on his reasons in a blog with stable sponsors Unibet. So he's given information out on Twitter, given information out on his blog, for which presumably he's getting paid, but hasn't scratched the horse from the race just yet. So a bit of I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed when it comes to the racing.
London Times, England leaves Anderson for last few tests. That's James Anderson, who of course played a crucial role for England in their test win in Cape Town. He's going to miss the remainder of the series. Saracens, meanwhile, face a 70-point hit. But it was decided that such a thing wouldn't be done because that would not be in the spirit of the competition, because, of course, what Saracens did was perfectly in the spirit of the competition and didn't deserve a 70-point hit. And this is a great story. Brands calms Everton fans. So the Everton director of football, Marcel Brands, held talks with a group of angry supporters who attempted to confront the club's players at the training ground after their FA Cup defeat to Liverpool. Imagine that, showing up to training and there's a lot of fans and there's a director telling them to stay away for a moment and you can't actually tell the players what you think.
The Daily Mirror there, back page, painful. Maguire facing a lengthy spell out with torn hip muscle. Fergie and Ed Woodward stunned by Derby thrashing. Well, I mean, Woodward probably should have seen it coming. Kel hell for Villa. It's a picture of Kelechi Iheanacho's goal to give Leicester a 1-1 draw.
And it is that picture on the front page of the Daily Telegraph sports section. Bold from the blue, super sub Iheanacho rescues Foxes.
And the back page of The Guardian this morning is lack of moral leadership, FA urged to drop live cup deal with betting companies. This is the story in the UK that almost all of the games in the FA Cup were live on various betting websites at the weekend in the UK, when only two games were shown on terrestrial TV. And it has sparked an outcry saying that this is a dangerous path that we're heading down. Turning to the big story of the morning next, News Talk business editor Vincent Wall is going to join us to discuss the appointment of the three independent FAI directors after these.
Off the Ball, 2019 IMRO Radio Awards Sports Programme of the Year.
Salah takes a shot. Oh!
See their dreams turn into reality. Whose names will be etched in history forever?
Offtheball.com, best online publisher at the 2019 Spider Awards.
A big breaking story on offtheball.com for you this morning. We have the very latest on the Mayo leaks. We now know what went on in that secretive Mayo County Board meeting.
2019 Irish Sponsorship Awards, Best Radio Sponsorship, OTB Super Value GAA Roadshows.
Well, Pentacles back, get your arse back here, he said. Star is out sitting on the swing and Darren O'Sullivan is pushing him.
OTB Sports Radio, live, online 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
Right, we've got Vincent Wall from News Talk Business Breakfast with us in studio to talk to us about what's going on at the FAI. Vincent, before we get into the identity of Roy Barrett and what he might do, just from your take as an observer of this over the last while, corporate governance and the importance of a strong financial backbone in a sports organisation. You know, these stories kind of rumble along in Irish sports once every two decades or every decade or so. Are we getting better as a country? Is this the type of thing that, we understand that we actually need, that it's important that, you know?
We would have thought we had improved, Ger, but I mean, what's emerged in the FAI over recent years, now everybody knew, even those not as closely linked to sport like myself, but everybody knew that John Delaney had a very strong personal authority over most things that happened in the FAI, but the extent to which the former board, the outgoing board, seemed to be completely cowed by him and dominated by him. I think in an era when such a focus on corporate governance in every sort of organisation, from large corporations to charities, and we've seen problems there, where there's been such a focus on it, on getting that right and making sure that the lines of separation in terms of decision making and strategic guidance are clear, it's still a huge shock at how bad it was in the FAI.
The charity sector is actually interesting. I haven't heard anybody bring that up before. There have been significant turnarounds in big organisations who had public trust, lost public trust, and who have started to gain it back by appointing independent boards and having a clean sweep. So there is a template. There's a template in Irish life to fix this.
There is absolutely a template, and that's the one, I suppose, that the both Sports Ireland and the government are trying to follow, and UEFA perhaps. But it's going to take time. They're the first immediate steps to put a board in place, and through a board, I suppose, a chief executive in time that slowly start making the right decisions, start saying the right things, start communicating properly with all stakeholders, not just internally to staff as well. But that takes time. It's going to take an awful lot of time to build up that trust again.
How do you do that? Is that
by being honest, firstly?
Okay, that helps.
Clear, honest, transparent communications as often as they can. They obviously, you know, an organisation like the FAI that is in such debts now and will be in such sensitive discussions with the likes of banks, with other stakeholders, including UEFA and with the government in terms of its ongoing subsidy, they won't be able to tell every iota at, you know, whenever journalists or others want it. But when information is expected, reasonably expected, they should be absolutely clear and forthright and straightforward. That's the start.
So you put a plan in place, you do a deal with the banks, which I haven't quite worked out exactly how, what the government involvement is going to be. Will there be cash from the government? Will it just be a guarantee?
I honestly don't know. But the banks are going to need some sort of ultimate underwriter if they do a deal. Now, there's all sorts of arrangements out there, basically, that the existing loans can be extended and therefore the payments are kicked down the line. But I would think banks are commercial organisations and they will ultimately require some sort of underwriting, not necessarily a guarantee, but underwriting, whether that's the government or whether that's UEFA.
So underwriting, how would that work? There would be actually no money.
Ultimately, if the FAI failed to meet the new covenants, the new agreements in place, that somebody will step in, that the banks will have surety, somebody will step in. The FAI has very few physical assets, as we know.
Yeah. So that wouldn't actually mean cash from the taxpayer so much as an agreement that we will, you know, if this new board doesn't work and if the company doesn't attract sponsors, then the taxpayer will have to step in and foot the bill for the Aviva or whatever it is.
I can imagine any government very reluctant to put the taxpayer on the line here. So where UEFA come into this, I don't know. But the one physical asset the FAI has is its share in the Aviva. But that, as Martin Murphy, the director of the Aviva Stadium, and others have pointed out, is an extremely difficult asset to sell because of the way it's linked in with other issues and with the IRFU.
It's also not an asset that's you're selling forever. It's a short term, not that short term, it's like another 30 years left on that, but it's a lease arrangement. So it's complicated.
Very complicated.
Tell us about Roy Barrett. What would you expect somebody who is the MD of Good Buddy Stockbrokers to bring to an organisation now?
Yeah, firstly, I think a lot of people, including myself, were very surprised when Roy Barrett's name was mentioned, firstly in the Irish Times yesterday morning, to be fair. He is very media shy. I know him a long time, but not well, because he tends to shun people like us publicly, like journalists, and that's his prerogative. But, you know, he's been managing director of Good Buddy Stockbrokers, one of the largest brokerages in the country, for 24 years now.
Right.
And he's brought that company through a number of very significant changes. It was owned by AIB. AIB had to sell it as part of the whole financial crash back in 2010. It then became partly owned by management, including himself, and by Fexco of Kerry. And at the moment, intriguingly, it's being bought in a 150 million euro deal by the Bank of China.
Right.
So there are big issues coming down the line and big opportunities for Goodbody itself. And there's no expectation that Roy Barrett is going to leave Goodbody. It's an exciting time for him. But he's very astute financially, very well respected in financial, and I think probably in political circles as well, because you know there would have been a lot of political toing and froing when AIB had to sell Goodbody back in 2010. So I think he's just a very respected, very astute figure, if low profile. Still, it was a surprise to me. I didn't realise he had the football links he has, even though they're under the radar. No previous links with the FAI, but close to Niall Quinn, as we know, and was named in that reform document that the Quinn Group put together last year. I gather he played at a pretty serious level for UCD, where he did a law degree back in the day. A serious Leeds United fan, which we won't hold against him, but, you know, he...
it's coming good for him.
It's coming good for him. And I gather hasn't missed an Irish international, good, bad, friendly or competitive, for nearly 30 years.
How autonomous do you expect someone like Roy Barrett to be within all of this? How much responsibility do you think the FAI will allow him to have, and how much direction will they take from an independent chairman?
Well, within the FAI, so we need to distinguish between what an independent chairman in any organisation does and what a chief exec. So the first thing they will, amongst the first things they will need to do is to advertise for a new chief executive. Mm. And the way it works in any organisation, if corporate governance is correct, is that the chief executive and the management team, and they will have to be put in place, will basically set out a strategy that the board will then either approve or not. But within the FAI itself, the new board and the other new directors coming in will have very significant authority, because one, they will approve the senior management team and put their shape on that. And secondly, that management team, whatever strategy they come up with, financial development, any of that, will have to go to that board for approval. And given the weakness of management in the FAI over recent years, that board will have very significant authority.
Yeah, you'd imagine that they'll be looking to these three figures as a huge source of education for future boards, because like you look at the disparity between the experience of someone of these three names and someone like John Delaney, who clearly, I guess, was constantly within football administration, made a mess of the thing at the end. You look at these three characters, and I grant we're at the outset here, we haven't seen their track record with the FAI for a second just yet, but it looks like they're the type of people who aren't going to mess it up too dramatically.
Well, I suppose one of the key differences between what these people will do and what John Delaney did, and leaving aside the question marks over what John Delaney did, I mean, John Delaney was the chief executive. He, in an organisation that had proper corporate governance, he would have laid his plans. He would have had a good relationship with the board, that's required, but he would have laid his plans in front of a board, and basically that board, you know, should challenge those plans, should challenge them, and in certain circumstances, in terms of where the financial mess that the FAI has got to now, should have rejected those plans. So what this board will do, these new independent directors, particularly Roy Barrett, the new chairman, is they will challenge the management team that they put in place, every decision they make, guide them, challenge them, and if needs be, if they feel certain decisions or certain plans are too risky or not, they'll reject them. Yeah. And they have the authority to do that.
Vincent, when you see these names, so it's Roy Barrett, it's Catherine Guy and Liz Joyce, none of these names were speculated about until yesterday, obviously. So there was no sense that these were available. You know, we didn't know who these... And we shouldn't really be talking about the independent directors on the board. Like, we don't really ever talk about the IRFU board or really the executive of...
That's because it works well.
...of the GEA. Exactly. So, you hope that these people are not high profile anyway, because something has gone wrong. They've been called before an Oireachtas committee for something that's gone wrong. But they seem like they're fairly heavy hitters. It seems like the FAI and AMROP, who went out to seek these people, have done a good job so far.
Yeah, it does look that way. I mean, you know, particularly in terms of the chairmanship, I know AMROP were out there for the months before Christmas, very much guided and in touch with Sport Ireland all the time as well, I believe, looking for a big, respected, experienced figure in the corporate world. And I know the likes of Maurice Pratt was approached, former Quinsworth and retail executive, very, very respected figure. He turned it down in the end. But what they were looking here for here was experience, was credibility, was a safe pair of hands, people who could, as you say, guide a new management team, give confidence back to the people who work for the FAI and for the people who, customers and supporters all around the country, that somebody decent is in charge at last. And as you say, Catherine Guy, a very senior lawyer, running a firm herself now, Sixt Car Leasing. Liz Joyce, a very, and HR is going to be a big issue for the FAI going
especially
forward.
Especially with potential layoffs.
She's a senior. So these people won't take the actual executive decisions, but they will be there to guide, challenge, and ultimately approve the decisions that the new management team will take.
Roy Barrett's going to walk into any room in Dublin with bankers, with government, and immediately everybody's going to be going, right, this is serious.
Yeah, this is serious. That's not to say he's going to get his own way. That's not to say that it's not going to be a very difficult, challenging road to try and offset or kick down the road a lot of those debts and their repayment schedules. But he starts by being a hugely respected figure.
Vincent, great stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. That's Vincent Wall. Check him out on News Talk Breakfast every morning. It is 1 minute past eight this morning here on Thursday morning on OTB AM. We're going to be back with your top five stories in the morning after these.
OTB AM.
Right, you're very welcome back. Here are the top five stories of the morning. Tom Brady took to Instagram yesterday to say, I know I have a lot more to prove, which means that he's going to play next year. We'll get into that in a little bit later. Joey Carby's injury, the worst case scenario, was confirmed. Johan van Grant says 2 to 4 months. 2 to 4 months is a big difference. 4 months is twice as long as 2 months, as we obviously know. So is he going to be back after 2 months? Is he going to be back after 4 months? We would hope it's closer to two. But I think giving people that sense that this might be a worst case scenario, 4 months would end up being April. And really then, is Joey Carby coming back for a playoff scenario, hopefully, if things somehow improve with Munster, and then the summer tour to Australia? It's a devastating blow to him and his injury profile, given that he's played, what, four starts for Munster in the last 12 months. The FIA directors have been named. We've just gone through those in detail with Vincent Wall. If you missed that, you can check it back on our podcast a little bit later on. We'll have it on all our social channels in just a couple of minutes' time. Jack McCaffrey was out doing a round of media yesterday and was very interesting. We're going to get to some of his stuff. He repeated his point that he thinks the advanced mark is a bit of a disaster for the game. I have to say, I think a lot of people agree with that. And the big story of the morning is actually Declan Bonner, the Donegal manager, saying that he's not going to field a team for the McKenna Cup game. We have a little bit of audio for that now. I can bring you this here. Here he is speaking to Highland Radio last night after the McKenna Cup win against Derry last night.
Whoever fixed the cigarettes in the middle of this campaign, it's absolutely ridiculous. I don't know, do the colleges or the authorities in GA or Ulster Council, do they communicate or what? But it's left the situation because, as I said, we have a lot of young lads, they're all at third level, some of them are on scholarships, and they have to play with their colleges, and that's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. We always treat the McKenna Cup with the respect it deserves, but if you can't put out a team, you can't put out a team. I'm not going to go around club players now that haven't done any work for the last 3 months to go and fill numbers for the weekend, you know, but we'll just wait and see. Even to a Tuesday night or would be an option, to be quite honest. I know, you know, and again, talking to the medical team, and there, a lot of those guys are playing a lot of football. I mean, this is I said this at the weekend, it is crazy stuff that we're playing. You know, some of these guys could be playing four matches in the space of 10 days, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very difficult. So we've got to manage that there. And in terms of the player welfare, we've got to be very, very careful, as I say. But at this stage where we stand in the minute, we won't have the numbers to field.
In a way, the best thing might be for them not to field, because then everybody starts to take the problem seriously, right? This goes back to the interview that we did with Luke Keeney about young players, specifically the young players who were playing Sigerson under 20 and senior intercounty, or Sigerson and intercounty. The level of training that they're doing, the level of responsibility that they feel to their county team, and of course to the scholarships, as he said, they have to play, they feel they have to play, and I mean, maybe they do, maybe they don't, but certainly they would feel an obligation, given that they have been given an educational pathway on the basis of their footballing ability, to show up and play in the Sigerson, that maybe the right thing to do here is for Donegal to say, no, we can't. Mm. And this is a pinch point where we're actually going to start dealing with this issue, as opposed to like, sure, look, it's only the preseason, it doesn't matter. This is exactly the time of year when players are travelling to train and doing the hard slog of preseason training, playing in the games, it doesn't make any sense. We're flogging the best thing that we have, which is our intercounty players.
Yeah, so needlessly as well. The pre-season competitions just don't fit into the entire calendar of the GAA as it stands. Like, there has to be some sort of betting in process before any season starts, but the idea that these tournaments exist is kind of ridiculous.
Make the interprovincials the betting in process before a league-based system starts, and at the end of the league-based system, somebody wins the Sam Maguire.
Yeah, exactly, and that's your...
And there's relegation and promotion, and make it, like, I know this, we can only have a second tier. What's the point in having only a second tier? It's going to be loads of dead rubbers. Have four tiers, and then everything matters because of promotion and relegation.
Having three different competitions in one season is just stupid. Simple as that. The fact that there is a competition now before you get into your secondary competition before your primary competition is ridiculous. It's interesting that he mentions the Sigurdsson Cup there. Like, I often wonder if that's one of the things that we just don't make better use of from the GAA. Now, it's great to see that they've condensed it dramatically this year, but I'm just saying before we came on air, why not make this like what they do with college sports in the US?
Yeah.
Exactly, and these games are on in the middle of the day. Well, sorry, I'm going off historical evidence here. It's another on weekends predominantly this year, but they've been played in the middle of the day on like Wednesday afternoon. Why not put them under lights, put them on TG Cahir, and everybody's watching these games that are, in some cases, a better standard than club games, which everybody watches at the weekend anyway.
But they're vastly better standard than
because
club
you've
games.
Got a huge swathe of intercounty players in each game. Because they're full-time students, for the most part, they will be able to play nighttime during the week. You've got games every single night, play it off in 2 weeks, and all of a sudden you've got a more condensed competition where nothing else can touch it, and also you've got a really exciting product that the GAA can have to kick off the calendar year. And then just scrap the pre-season competitions if they exist, though. Like, I mean, I think it should be up to every county should have the option to just field their under-20 team. Because like you really do have a lot of sympathy with Declan Bonner in this situation.
I think there is something about the money raised goes to help ex-players. Certainly something about the money raised for these competitions is ring-fenced for something specific. And obviously they have a history and a tradition, but it just doesn't fit currently. And with the various fixture proposals that are on the table at the moment, the problem is that when you've got five or six options, you've got no options. There should be like a, do you want things to stay exactly the same, or are we going to go to this one staging post, which is a base camp for us to evolve into whatever's coming next? But let's get into a holding pattern where at least it's like fewer games at the same time and a specific off season where you're not asked to train, where you can go on holidays, where you can do the things, and then a set template. And if you want to layer in another competition afterwards, if there's room between the provincial championships and the Sam Maguire, if there's room between whatever for these cups, bring them back. But something has to give now. And the best thing Donegal could do for all of Gaelic football would be, we're not going, because the easy thing would be to put out a mix and gather them to play. Like, you'll have 15 players, right? They'll have 15 who could start, and then, you know, everybody plays the full thing. They end up with 12 because two lads go off injured and whatever. I don't know.
When you talk about having potential room in the calendar to fit it in or whatever, maybe that room in the calendar should just be left as room for the players that are out there
exactly.
giving the slog
exactly.
to actually take a bit of time off.
I wasn't advocating that, but yeah.
Like, you talk about the fact that the competition perhaps means things to people at the kind of cup, and you see the big attendances. An Ulster Championship already exists. You can decide if you're better than your neighbour in the summer. Like, that's it. You don't need two Ulster Championships. That's what it is. I can never understand why these competitions are there.
Because it's been so long since there's been inter-county action. Like, it's been...
And there's an appetite.
It's been exactly. And I understand that. But you would make that appetite even stronger mm-hmm. if you condense the season. Like, a really short NFL season is a brilliant thing. It's a massive, amazing... And then the off-season, everybody talks about it because it fills that want. I actually think it would improve the attendances at club matches in that this would be the only way to see these players.
It would definitely increase further the profile of the club players who are making it to the end of the year, for sure. Like, I don't know. Like, so the NFL example is a great one because it does leave you wanting more coming back to every single season. I guess there is some sort of inferiority complex within some quarters of the GAA sometimes, within Gaelic games in general, I mean, that we always need to be in the spotlight. That when the All-Ireland final was moved forward, it's like, well, we're losing our great soapbox that is September. And it's like, actually, let's just try this thing out for a little bit longer. Maybe if we have an intense inter-county season throughout the few months of the year, perhaps it'll hit you harder and it'll be better. And who cares about the competition with other sports? And because Premier League is back and in full flow, or whatever the arguments were, like, I think maybe just focusing on what's best for those people who already love Gaelic games is probably the way forward, rather than concerns about taking the sport away from the spotlight.
So we had an inter-county Gaelic footballer in this week saying he fell out of love with the game. We had Luke Healy telling us exactly the same thing, by falling out of love with the game. Over 60 players are stepping away from inter-county squads. Bear in mind that a lot of these are now players who've come through the entire development squad system. So the architecture of that county has said from the time those kids are 12 or 14 that we think you're going to be an inter-county footballer, they are fulfilling their destiny according to what the local GAA hierarchy says for them. And they're getting to that point, which should be the absolute peak and the best excitement. It's like, oh, we're bubbling up to a point where we're going to be as good as we can ever be. And they're stepping away. Something is wrong. Mm. You're literally doing the thing that we've laid out this pathway for you to get to. And you're like, I don't want that for me and for my life. Why is that?
In some ways... This is a terrible thing to say, like, I'll admit that, but in some ways the people who are walking away from panels, they should be anonymous to you and I. These should not be high profile players. We should not be able to recognise the list of 60 players that are walking away. It should be the people, and I'm not saying it's right, that are churned out through the development squad teams, that are churned out through underage football and then are spat out like a piece of meat. It's terrible, but that is almost more understandable than what the current situation is, where you have players who have established themselves in the inter-county game, have been in the... Gary Brennan is one of the players who stepped away this year. Like, we don't know what the full reasons are yet or anything like that, but like, there shouldn't be people who are in the mix for All-Stars deciding that their sport isn't for them at the peak of their career.
The problem is that you have nothing to play for if you're playing against Dublin every year and you're from 29 counties, 28 counties, right? There's literally no point because you know you're going to get hammered by them. Whereas if you were in Division 4 and everybody got together and said, we should be a Division 2 team, lads, and if we win Division 4, there's going to be a team holiday for us, then all of a sudden those games matter. And that whole system works.
And it comes back to your point about splitting it into four rather than two, because if you are that team that has got hockeyed by Dublin in Division 1 and you end up finishing rock bottom, at least there's this little inkling of hope where you're like, well, actually, we're competing in a division or an area that we can actually top next year. We can actually go to the very top of our area next year. We don't always have to be running into this roadblock of Dublin. You'd like to think that at least a top six team should be able to compete with one another, and that everybody from two to six has some sort of hope of at least having a plan of taking on the Dubs and beating them like they would in Division 1 of the Football League, and that those teams who finish bottom at least have Division 2 to look forward to next year. If that is your summer competition, you mean flipping the calendar, then I think that everybody at least has a silver lining at the end of a bad year.
But those matches in Division 4 would mean something. Those matches in Division 3 would mean something. I think you're less likely to step away from the panel when... So, if Cavan had come up, they would have been a great story coming up from Division 3, winning Division 3, winning Division 2 and getting into Division 1. As it is, they're a team who has been coming off the back of horrific criticism about their style of play and now being called underperformers. And that's the narrative around Cavan football in the last couple of years, as opposed to what a great surge they've been. Like, they've got the crowd behind them, they've got an identity, they've got a style, they've won, they've had a bit of success. That's not the narrative around Cavan football, is it?
It's true. The narrative around Cavan football is, and it is the same at every county, it's who beat you last in the championship? And their last memory of the championship is Tyrone dismantling them. And that is what people remember, despite the fact that they've been a Division 1 team.
Let's move on, because we got Jack McCaffrey in studio last night, and he's always very interesting. He's got a big, broad cultural hinterland. He's got a great perspective on life. He talked about how important sport is in the aftermath of the 5 in a row when he went to the Children's Hospital. It was something that really rang a bell for a lot of people. It was like, no, sport isn't just this triviality. It's this really important thing that lifts people out of the issues that they find them in, however temporarily. Here he is talking about Desi Farrell taking over the Dublin job. Have a look.
Desi Farrell, how well do you know him? Were you just past the group who came through?
Did you work under him? Yeah, so it was kind of my year. That's kind of the split. So from myself down, we'd all have kind of been coached or managed by Desi at some point, and from myself up, wouldn't have. So I know Desi really, really well. Obviously, I haven't played under him in 6 years. Mm. So it's been a while, and I'm sure he's changed a bit, no more than I have. But really excited to see what he brings to the table. I think he was absolutely the most logical and best choice for Dublin. I was just worried that he wouldn't be available because I know he's a very busy man and it's a big commitment. But I'm delighted he's taken it up. And I suppose we haven't really started yet, so it's hard to comment on it. But sure. But I really hope it, and I feel like it will go very well.
They haven't really started yet. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, like they haven't started yet, and they're the All Ireland champions, and loads of other teams have been back since grinding since November and December, going, "Oh, we've got to get this, we've got to do this, we've got to." And it's like, well, do they have to do that? Obviously, the Dubs have an easier situation in loads of different ways, and we know that. But like, killing your team in November and December might just be killing your team.
It's true. It's hard to argue against that. Like, and I'm sure that there are players who are killing themselves in other ways at the moment. Like, it's exam season in a couple of colleges, for example, and things like that. January can be a tough month for people without the actual grind of pre-season and training for a season that shouldn't peak really until June or July, which again is kind of a bit ridiculous. But yeah, it's interesting that like he kind of confirms the suspicion that everybody has around Dublin at the moment, which is that Desi Farrell will pick up where Jim Gavin left off largely. And it's difficult to actually make a case that he is going to alter things drastically.
Has he named his whole backroom team? Do we know what the coaching setup is going to be? Do we know
the media event before the end of the week? So I'm sure.
Do we know what the philosophy is going to be? Like, will they have the basketball element?
Well,
like,
we definitely won't know that at the media event this week, I dare say. But we might find that out in time. Like, the 25th of January is going to be an interesting occasion. Like, I'm sure many neutrals are going to pop their head into Croke Park that night if they're not from Dublin but living in Dublin, for example, just to see what exactly Desi Farrell comes up with. Like,
what do you think? Does he have to go balls out to try and win the league to make everybody think, okay, this is what we are? Or is it the complete opposite? It's like, another league title means nothing to you lads, and I'm not here to win a league title. I'm here to win all Ireland's, and I'm also here to say we're starting from scratch. It's a zero. How do you do this?
You have to win the league. You have to go gung-ho to win the league. Now, that may not be possible from Dublin side of things. Like you said, apparently you're hearing information that I'm not, that Kerry are apparently training on holidays. I'm not sure if Dublin are doing the same thing at the moment. In Bali, I suspect they probably aren't. I suspect they're rightfully drinking from a coconut. I think he did his holiday after the Leaving Cert, after the All-Ireland, I should say. Same thing. So he was on that trip. But
you have recurring dreams where you wake up and it's like 3 minutes to go in the drawing game.
Every holiday is a post-Leaving Cert holiday in my book. So, like, maybe it's not possible for him to win the league. Maybe people just won't be fit enough and he won't be back into the swing of things. But I think if you're Desi Farrell, you have to win the league. You have to put a marker down, not only to the rest of the country, but to your own squad.
I think you say, look, lads, we can go and we can win the league and you can all have a big celebration after winning the league. Or we can try and do some new things.
Or you can go and win the league, have a few pints that night at the end of the league. Like, have a few drinks in the middle of the league before the week off.
I'm not talking about the pints.
Like, I mean, like, go on, like...
No, I don't mean that. I'm talking about trying new things, like, and what's important is your style of play, your philosophy, how you're going to get through the big games when they come down the line. Is winning the league going to be something that helps them with that? Because if you try and win... Because every new coach needs to come in and do something different. Do you think that the right thing to do is just to change nothing and not evolve? Okay. Kerry got so close.
Okay, so there's a little bit of evolution that's probably required in certain areas, but like I would have thought that is it more of a solid defensive plan in the post Keane O'Sullivan era that perhaps is coming down the tracks in the next few years? Is it evolving so that no matter who is partnering Brian Fenton, you have more cohesion in attack because Michael Darren McCauley, he might start winding down the next couple of years. I know people have said that about him so many times and it hasn't happened to date. They're the sort of evolutions. It's a personnel-based evolution, I would have thought, rather than saying, right, this is his blueprint, now this is my blueprint. The best blueprint we've ever seen in the GAA already exists right there. So you've got to be very careful, I would have thought.
So do the same thing, win the league, roll on.
But I think as a new manager, you have to go win your first competition.
Hashtag unstoppable juggernaut. Get that out there.
Apparently, you're the guy who coined that phrase.
I did, yeah.
Congratulations to you, unstoppable.
It's my greatest achievement. 21 minutes past 8 this morning. We're moving on to rugby next here on OTBAM. Myself and Owen are going to be choosing our Ireland 23 to face Scotland because, you know, that's one of those jobs that we have. By the way, so much else in that Jack McCarthy interview to get your teeth into. He talks about Jim Gavin's departure and going out with him and having a few drinks that night. The All-Ireland final build-up, the final 10 minutes of the first game where he was actually saying, maybe this is one of those occasions where it's not going to happen for us, which is one of those reasons why I think Kerry are going to win the All-Ireland this year because they're so close. I know you don't agree. But anyway, the incoming advance mark, I'll talk about that already, which he thinks is terrible. But rugby next, right? So here's Andy Dunn on JJ Hanrahan. Have a look.
Their options, should Hanrahan be deemed not fit enough, are Ben Healy, 20 years of age, played in November against Edinburgh, has never played in Europe before, or increasingly, it seems, Rory Scannell.
Yeah, I think, firstly, I can't see JJ being given the go ahead from the medical team, just because of the time frames. Late December and mid-January, if he tweaked his hamstring, even mildly, like a grade one tweak of a hamstring with my physio hat on, is still 3 to 4 weeks, you know. He could jog in a straight line and he can accelerate a bit and slow down, but play a crucial knockout European game in terms of acceleration and deceleration and sudden bursts of speed that he'll need to make, that's where your hamstring doesn't hold up. So I can't see it. I just can't see the medical team saying go on out and give it a try, because if it goes after 10 minutes, they've lost the player, obviously. In terms of the options then, if it was a game to really just, you know, go over and there's no chance of qualification, you know, maybe go with
Ben Healy.
Yeah. But I think in this case I would go with Scannell, even though it's not his position. Scannell's one of these, he's a bit different. He's a 12 who's, in John Giles' terminology, he's a footballing 12. He's not a crash bang wallop merchant. He's a really kind of cultured left boot.
Andy Dunn on last night's Off the Ball. You can check out the full piece on offtheball.com, youtube.com/offtheball as well. As you can see, we're back beside our brand new Samsung Flip. We are picking our Ireland team for the opening game against Scotland in this year's Six Nations. We're going to cycle through them. There's going to be a couple of bones of contention, you'd imagine. This is my team. If I was picking the team, this is the team I want to see start for Ireland. Just to clarify, that is very different from the team that probably should start for Ireland. I'm going with Keane Healy at number one, because, you know, we're going to count up the numbers because we're not true rugby men. Keane Healy, number one. Ronan Kelleher, assuming he's fully fit, I'd like to see him as hooker. Tadhg Furlong holding on to the three jersey. Ian Henderson and James Ryan is my ideal second row. And then my back row of Peter O'Mahony, Josh Van der Fleer. Boring so far, but I would give Caelan Doris the number 8 jersey going into the Scotland game. At scrum half, I'd go for John Cooney. At out half, it's going to be Ross Byrne, really, at this point, with all the injury concerns we have. On the wings, I've got Keith Earls and Jacob Stockdale. Gary Ringrose at outside centre, because he is the best 13 we have, no question about that. So I got to the number 12 jersey. The person I would give the 12 jersey to right now, because, you know, I like fun things rather than the sort of perhaps the winning option, I'd be picking Chris Farrell. I just love seeing Chris Farrell in an Ireland jersey. He hasn't really let us down on any occasion so far. Himself and Gary Ringrose is an experiment that I want to see happen. 15, it's Jordan Larmour. My replacements then, on the bench, we've got Rob Herring, Dave Kilcoyne, Andrew Porter. John Klein, I think, deserves another go in the green jersey. CJ Stander coming off the bench as well, alongside Conor Murray, Robbie Henshaw and Will Addison. I know it's a bit of a... That's definitely a bench set Andy Farrell wouldn't pick, position-wise, but no out half, you'll notice there. Conor Murray is the guy I would be choosing as my substitute out half.
So here's a team that's going to beat your team, right? This is the team that's going to beat Owen's team. I've got Dave Kilcoyne starting, because obviously he was the forward number one and really deserves his opportunity at this stage. Ronan Kelleher, again, it's fitness dependent. I'm starting with Andrew Porter because I'm going for the whole point that we're picking on form. And at the moment, Andrew Porter is just that little bit ahead of Tadhg Furlong, but wait until you see my bench. James Ryan, Ian Henderson. I think Ian Henderson's pretty lucky to get into the Ireland team. Definitely needs some big games for Ireland at this point and is being very pressurised by somebody who's on my bench but not on Owen's bench. I've got Jack O'Donoghue at number 6. If you're being compared to Rocky Elsom, as he was by Gordon Darcy yesterday, now is the time. He's 25. It's the right stage of his career to be putting him in the team. Josh Van der Fleer at 7, I think, is probably a shoe-in at this stage. And Caelan Doris is suddenly quite quickly becoming somebody who everybody is agreeing needs to be very close to starting this game. So it's really between Doris and Stander. I haven't put Stander on my bench. Oh, I have, sorry. Cooney's 9, Ross Byrne is 10. I think at this point, because of fitness and form, there's not really going to be that much debate. It's a big test of Andy Farrell, I think, to see exactly how much pressure he's on to win these games if he goes with Murray to start the tournament. Now, maybe he picks Murray in the first game, he picks Cooney in the second game, and he mixes up the whole way along, and that's totally fine as well. But I just think the message you send, Keith Earls back to fitness, and I think that we should not be throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. Keith Earls, one of the most dynamic, brilliant players that we have. Bundiaki, Gary Ringrose, Stockdale, and Jordan Larmour. Who did you have at 11?
I had Earls and Stockdale as well on the wings.
Okay, so we're very similar, almost exactly the same. Stockdale, again, has played his way back into form in the last couple of weeks and gets back in at 14. Ringrose at 13 is undroppable. And look, at 12, you could have Henshaw, Henry, or Bundiaki. They're all fit at the minute. My replacements, my Lions bench, Keane Healy, Tadhg Furlong, Niall Scannell.
Scannell should wear the 16 jersey, but we won't get into semantics here.
Grant. Devon Toner's back on the bench. And I think Keith Wood had a good line about him having a bit of bite, a little bit of nastiness at the moment. And that's exactly what this Ireland team needs. And there's no way that I'm throwing him out at the moment. I've got a 6-2 split because I think at the minute that's kind of what we need. And it gives the opportunity against Scotland, if things aren't going well, to roll on Peter O'Mahony, CJ Stander, and Keane Healy and Tadhg Furlong at the same time, and you're looking over the bench going, oh Jesus, look at this. See, I think that would be pretty amazing. We've got Conor Murray at 22 and Andrew Conway at 23. I think Conway could probably be starting, and I think he's pushing. There's no way I'd not have him in my 23, irrespective of how well Will Addison's playing.
A 6-2 split. Do you want to sing the South African national anthem while you're at it as well? This is an absolute disgrace on Irish rugby that you would suggest such a thing. A couple of interesting things there, I'm not sure where you want to start. We might start with the backs because we're fairly similar except for midfield.
A bit too similar, yeah.
So I want to see Chris Farrell play as many games as possible. I admit, I hold my hands up and say it's probably not going to happen. But what could possibly happen, and I think it's been floated in the mail this morning by Hugh Farrelly, is that this weekend, for example, in the Red of Munster, you could have a situation where Rory Scannell moves into out half and then you've got this hole at 12. Now, Chris Farrell, we haven't seen play 12 too often in Ireland, but he has played there for Grenoble in the past. He has been speaking about playing at 12 in the past and says he greatly enjoys it. And it's something we haven't seen too often. I would just like to see him play 12 at some stage for Munster and then perhaps make this a concrete case. I'll completely say this is a fanciful idea.
I don't think it's fanciful at all.
Of him at inside centre.
I don't think so.
But imagine how much fun
it
would be.
Is that where he started with Ireland? Was it in the Six Nations?
In the Wales game?
Yeah, I thought that's what...
When we were so injury... ravaged in midfield. Potentially, I would love to see a midfield of Farrell and Ringrose at some stage. And you know what? Maybe Scotland is the perfect opportunity for that to happen. Like, maybe it isn't a summer test or a November test.
I think Andrew Conway has to be in the conversation for selection.
It's true. And maybe...
And you might even have him ahead of Earls at this point, given the form that he's shown, and Earls is just coming back from injury. So Earls hasn't got quite back up to that level yet. But like we know from Brian O'Driscoll sitting here in studio telling us that of all the trainers that they have, Keith Earls trains the house down. And, you know, you pick on form and you pick on training. And I suspect at international level, there's always, always the inclination to go with the form and training because that's what they're doing for you. Mm. The bit where they're playing well in matches is outside the environment. When they're inside the environment, it's how do you do? And so if Keith Earls is like a legendary trainer and has obviously had an amazing Ireland career, has always been... even in defeat, has been frequently someone who puts his hand up and says, well, I did my bit.
Yeah.
I got yards. I made tackles. I made a try-saving tackle.
Conway came back from the World Cup with his reputation enhanced. One of the few people to do so.
Yeah.
So it definitely strengthens his case as well. Like, I'm going with Addison, basically, on the form he's shown over the past few weeks. Some people might make the case that he's a better fit than Jordan Larmour to start at 15 for Ireland. I disagree with that because I think Jordan Larmour is an absolute wizard. Like, you talk about the different combinations in the back three. If things aren't going well in a match, do you automatically go to a substitution, or do you say to yourself, let's try Stockdale out of 15 and let's shift Larmour to the wing and see what happens for us, and then perhaps have Addison as your wing option? I wouldn't necessarily be reaching for a Conway or an Addison from the bench immediately. Wouldn't mind.
That's why I'm having a 6-2 split. I don't, like...
That's a good point.
Unless there's an injury, right? But I think that this is something that we should be experimenting with, right? This is happening at various stages in world rugby, and generally with South African coaches, fair enough. But actually, like, my bench is amazing. It's an amazing bench. You've CJ Stander, Peter Mahoney, Devon Toner, Niall Scannell, Tadhg Furlong and Keane Healy. Between the 47th minute and the 60th minute, you're rolling that bench out?
Yeah.
You're kicking the shit out of anybody in that last 25 minutes.
Let me ask you a question then, because it's a question I asked myself picking my team. Is CJ Stander slash Peter O'Mahony here a better option off the bench when so you need somebody eager than Max Deegan? Like, I would put Reece Ruddock into that. Like, I'm talking about proven Irish international, Reece Ruddock in that CJ, Peter O'Mahony bracket as well. Yeah. Like, is Max Deegan actually the perfect impact sub at this point in his career?
I think that, look, probably there might be some data that suggests that you get better if you're introduced as a sub over a period of time, and you don't. But actually, I think that with all those young guys, start them. Give them 50 minutes. Tell them we really trust you and we're not going to take you off after your first mistake. If you come on as a sub, blood's up, you Trevor Brennan it a little bit, take the head off somebody in your first tackle, it's like, ooh, penalty given away, all of a sudden. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's just easier to start a game. You're into the rhythm of exactly knowing what your responsibilities are and cycle through these players. So I don't think we should have a fixed back row at the start of the Six Nations or at the end of the Six Nations, given how many back rowers we have. All of them should feel like they're in with a chance of being first choice over the next couple of years. What's the point in saying, well, we have these three and there are three and that's not moving? There's no point in that, it turns out. We've too many of them. So let's see what the combinations are. Let's work through until you get to a point where three of them are like, I am as good an option as there is in this hemisphere, and so you have to pick me week in, week out.
Possibly. Like, I think also as well, the reason why I settled on absolutely keeping CJ Stander on the bench rather than at Max Deegan is because it's CJ Stander. Like, we can't just put an age over his head and say, because you're probably not going to improve anymore in your career, therefore we have to have the upshoot guy. At this moment in time, of course we'd be picking CJ Stander over Max Deegan. Like, it was actually a big leap, big-ish leap on my part, actually, put Doris in there ahead of CJ Stander at this point. But I think given the new era that is dawning for Ireland, I think it's a necessary step to actually change things up a little bit.
Yeah, I also think that it would be good for us to get away from the whole you're the starter and you're nailed on and never ever will you not be a sub, which is kind of what we had under Joe Schmidt. There was like, there were starters and there were subs. We didn't have that whole sense of this being
the finishers.
Yeah, we didn't have that. We didn't really have that, did we?
That,
like,
it definitely felt like
you weren't in the starting team, you were dropped.
You definitely felt like,
and you were either dropped from the team to the replacements, or you were gone. Whereas what I'm saying is, like, why do we have to have that? Like, you know, like, in both these teams, you would have your captain on the field at the start of the game in the second row, and he would finish the game irrespective of whether or not Peter O'Mahony came on. Is James Ryan your captain the whole way through?
Yeah, I'd be picking James Ryan as my captain.
So I'd be picking CJ Stander as my captain, but he's on the bench and he takes the captaincy off James Ryan when he comes on.
So of all the players that you've started, James Ryan, like, I can see that. Like, who else, like, the other contenders are Sexton, O'Mahony, and that's really, like, you started Henshaw on your team? Henshaw's not in your squad.
No.
Why not?
It's Henshaw slash Conway on the bench. Whoever's fit and whoever's shown to me that week.
See, like, I'd
probably have Henshaw at 12. It's Henshaw or Bundy.
Henshaw and Ringrose, like, Andy Farrell is going to pick.
Yeah, and I've absolutely no problem with that. Like, if Henshaw is fully fit and is back to his best, he's like one of our best players.
Could go for Bundy as well, though, couldn't he? Like, definitely wouldn't be ruling him out of the equation there. So, I don't know. I just love a little bit of Chris Farrell.
Do you think he's going to pick? I think he's going to pick Healy, Scannell, Furlong.
Ryan Henderson. Josh Van de Vlier for sure.
Yeah.
And then you've got
Peter O'Mahony captain. And eight, I'm not sure he's going to go for Stander over Doris. And then I think he's going to go Cooney. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to go Cooney and he's going to go Ross Byrne because I think that's what the option is. I don't think it's going to be... I think that's what it's going to be. And then after that...
The back three are locked down, I think, at this point. I think it is going to be Earl Stockdale and Larmour. Because of what Larmour showed the Ireland jersey during the World
there's
Cup.
There's no significant change in that team.
And that's why we this morning picked the teams we would like to see, because it's not what we think is going to happen, because I think it's largely predictable, actually.
Cooney and Doris are new, if he picks them.
And
like, here's the thing, is it fair for both of them to have new players that they're working with on their debuts? You know, should Caelan Doris, when he starts and he's at the base of the scrum, have a Lions scrum half picking the ball off him? Or should he have a guy who's like, ooh, it's my first proper opportunity here too?
Well, I was more thinking 6 and 7, to be quite honest with you, and that's why I went for Peter O'Mahony and Josh van der Fleer, that his back row partners are established Irish internationals.
Yeah, look, I mean, you just want to see a little bit of... You want him to be free to go and say, look, this is going to be my team. I have a long-term contract. I don't really care about whether or not we lose this game. If it turns out what we unearth is an amazing partnership here and here and here, and we start to get our philosophy out. Can't do that, though, can you? You've got to be Scotland home.
All right, and also, it's putting the foot down and saying this is going to be my philosophy in your first Ireland cap is quite a ballsy thing to do.
8:37 a.m. this morning, you can give us your reaction to our Ireland teams. Pick your own. Use the hashtag OTBAM. As ever, you can get in touch with us by dropping a comment on the YouTube stream or indeed on the Facebook stream, where we broadcast live every morning from 7:30 here on Ireland's only sports breakfast show. You're watching OTBAM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. Sports news next with Tom Malone, but here's some more of Jack McCaffrey on Off the Ball. He is not happy with the advance mark.
I saw him, look, with a view to 2020, the attacking marks coming in, and I know you were very critical of that when it was first announced. Have you softened in that stance, or are you dreading this as much as ever?
No, I do think it's terrible, but I suppose I've probably resolved that I should at least see it before continue to...
But your fear, sorry, I should have said, for people who didn't see your initial comments, was effectively this is just increasing the likelihood of a stop-start game, which is the antithesis of what we want.
Yeah, and I think, since I've been involved with intercounty football, there have been a number of rule changes, and they've been kind of like where the kick out is taken from. There's the black card. There has been the midfield mark. I don't think any of them kind of intrinsically changed the way football is played, to be honest. And I think this has the potential to, a little bit. Again, I've decided I will sit on my hands a bit until it either works or it doesn't, because I'm sure people laboured over it long and hard and lost sleep over whether it was a good idea, and I'm just coming in kind of with my instincts, but I don't know, I presume it's been brought in to counter a very defensive football, which I don't think we're seeing as much of anymore.
No.
And also I think if you kind of logically work through this, it could actually have the exact opposite effect, in that you now have to mark a forward in a way that he cannot catch the ball clean, but you cannot overcommit because he'll turn you and score a goal. So probably the logical thing to do is to put someone in front of him and someone behind him. So,
yeah, the law of unintended consequences when it comes to changing GAA rules, as succinctly explained by Jack McCaffrey, one of the great thinkers of the game at the moment. Now, Tom Malone is here to talk to us about what's happening in the world of sports news. Tom.
Thanks, Jerry. Yeah, we'll start with GAA and Donegal senior football manager Declan Bonner has said the county will not be able to field a team in Sunday's Dr. McKenna Cup semi-final against Monaghan. Donegal may have up to 13 players involved in Sigerson Cup action this weekend. That's after they beat Derry by 110-8 points last night to qualify for the last four. That Monaghan match is due to throw in at noon on Sunday at a venue yet to be decided, but Bonner told Highland Radio he's hoping the game will be moved due to fixture congestion. The other semi-final, by the way, is Tyrone up against Down. In football, new independent chairperson of the FAI, Roy Barrett, says there's a serious job to be done to address what he describes as the association's very significant failures. The Goodbody managing director was one of three independent directors named by the FAI last night. Also up were the Central Bank's Director of Human Resources, Liz Joyce, and Autolease Fleece Management CEO, Catherine Guy. Their appointments could trigger the government bailout of the FAI, with Sports Minister Shane Ross set to meet UEFA this week. On the pitch last night, the Carabao Cup semi-final between Leicester and Aston Villa is delicately poised after that first leg at the King Power. They played out a 1-0 draw, with Kelechi Iheanacho's second half strike cancelling out Frederick Guibert's opener, levelling the tie. Leicester boss Brendan Rodgers says he's frustrated, though, that his side couldn't press home their dominance against Villa last night.
Well, overall, I thought we dominated the game. First half, a little bit passive. We had enough of the ball, but it was too slow. We didn't press the game in transition well enough. I thought second half we did that. We were very good, and they had some great blocks, and the keeper made some great saves to stop us winning the game.
The sides will reconvene at Villa Park 2 weeks from Tuesday in the second leg. While Manchester United defender Harry Maguire is set for up to 2 months on the sidelines with a muscle injury, that means manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer may have to now dip into the transfer market. While in golf, Shane Lowry carded a 1-under par 69 at the Hong Kong Open. His first round of 2020 leaves him 3 shots off the pace. Meanwhile, elsewhere, Jonathan Caldwell's 2-under par in his first round at the South African Open. Gavin Moynihan 1-under par Rasmus Højgaard leads that tournament on 5 under par. In cricket, Ireland will look for better in their second one international with the West Indies at Bridgetown later. The visitors fell to a 5-wicket defeat to the hosts on Tuesday. Play there set to get underway at 5 o'clock. In racing, the British Horse Racing Authority are sending a team of vets to the yard of Nicky Henderson this morning to examine Altior. The trainer announced via Twitter and his UniBet blog yesterday that the horse will not run this weekend at Kempton, but is yet to be officially scratched. Hence those vets being sent in. Rule 95.2 of the BHA says that non-runners should be scratched immediately, not waiting until the decks and making announcements elsewhere. That's sort of specifically in relation to those kind of corporate associations that trainers may have with bookmakers.
Yeah, because Altior's price drifted with bookmakers, including Unibet, before he was scratched. So
yes, before any announcement was made.
You can see that's not great.
Yeah,
that's...
Richard Forrestal has quite a decent column on it today in the Racing Post as well. Quite a few people have sort of voiced their unease on this situation with kind of relationship with racing professionals, be it trainers or jockeys and bookmakers. Now, some bookmakers do have explicit rules and they sign up their, I know some bookmakers in particular, they sign up their ambassadors to quite strict codes of conduct. I don't know what the situation at Unibet is, but whereby the blog should just be updates on runners, not breaking news stories or anything that could be regarded as market sensitive information.
Yeah.
So jurisdictions like Hong Kong and Australia have incredibly strict rules on this. It appears that the BHA have rules on this as well, but this is sort of the first time they've kind of come to light, even though incidents like this have been not as obvious as this in the past, but there's certainly been concerns about them.
This is Altior and Nicky Henderson.
This isn't exactly some pleasure at Wolverhampton at 7 o'clock on a Friday night. You know, it is the best horse in training, one of the most high profile trainers in the game, and you know, and they have actually been in trouble as well from advertising standards and before, because Unibet were running his Twitter account without sort of referencing it. So that there is a little bit of previous here.
Yeah, and look, it just the BHA needs to step in, and you'd like to see those regulations fairly clear so everybody understands that this isn't going to happen.
Absolutely, and there needs to be...
It's a call to stop the betting companies having jockeys and trainers as ambassadors and riders. I can see the benefit of that.
I can see that. I can understand having them, but if there are potential integrity concerns about the content, then there has to be incredibly strict rules that are incredibly strictly enforced on it. Anything, especially that could potentially be market-sensitive information, where a horse drifts from 4 to 6 to 5 to 2 in the morning.
Yeah, you're going to 5 to 2 for Altior, you're like, oh, this is great. And then
no, he's not. Yeah. But then the problem is the horse wasn't officially scratched, and that's why... You know, as soon as you make an announcement, you should go. So what should have happened here probably is Nicky Henderson should have rung PA, the Press Association, say there's an issue with Altior, and send it out that way. And then,
or scratch the horse first.
And scratch the horse simultaneously.
That's, yeah. All right, yeah. Tom, good stuff. We're going to talk football next this morning on OTBM. Former Ireland Spurs fullback Stephen Kelly is going to join us in studio. First, though, let's go back to last night's football show. BBC Scotland's Tom English spoke to the lads about Glenn Whelan's time at Hearts.
I don't think any of this should come as a surprise. The team is playing appallingly. Whelan had a good start with Hearts. He came in, played well, looked hungry, was having an influence. Mm. Fans liked him. And, you know, talking to some Hearts people today and a couple of other people around the club, they all felt that his heart wasn't quite in it, but that he was getting by, playing okay. And then when Republic of Ireland played Denmark, after that, it's been 7 games that Hearts have played since that game. And he hasn't looked the same player as he did before. He's looked, according to them, has looked disinterested, hasn't mixed with the other players that much, has built no relationship with the youth players around the club. Some of the youth players say, I don't think he even knows my name. So he hasn't invested, according to the fans and according to some people around the club, in the club the way they hoped he would. And I can tell you, if you look at the Hearts club forum, and I've a number of Hearts pals of mine, not one person is sorry to see him go. Not one.
Right, pretty damning stuff there from sources at Hearts talking to Tom English, and Tom English relaying that information on last night's football show. Stephen Kelly's with us this morning. Stephen, how are you doing?
Not too bad, Jerry, yourself?
Were you surprised to see the breakdown in relationship there at Hearts?
Yeah, it kind of came out of blue, didn't it? Like, I didn't really foresee it coming, and then the comments came out from the manager, and you kind of think, okay, everything's not kind of rosy here, and then all of a sudden he's gone. So it was kind of a strange situation where it happened so suddenly, but things like this happen in football, and you know he needs to find a club now, really. That's the main thing.
Is he not in the Ireland team if he doesn't have a club, or does Mick McCarthy pick him because Mick McCarthy loves him?
I suppose it's going to test Mick's philosophy if he wants players that are playing, doesn't it? And that's gone out the window, I think, throughout the campaign. So it's going to be down to how much he feels he's a vital part of the cog that he needs to get promoted.
Shane Long will be watching the situation interested. Yes. I'm just going to see how you treat this guy.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, the thing is for Shane as well. I think Shane, realistically, we've not been blessed with goal-scoring talent throughout this campaign at all. So I think Shane Long was always an option. I know he's not being the most informed striker, but he offers something slightly different than what we have. So not having him involved was kind of crazy at best point. I know he's been injured and stuff, but that didn't make sense for me. Glenn has been pivotal in everything Mick's done, realistically, and I need the big games he's played. So he's going to probably want him to play in this game because there's no bigger than that.
A lot of footballers, the end of their careers are completely different. Some footballers peter out over a period of time, and the age catches up with them slowly. Some of them, it's a cliff.
Yeah.
We don't know what the story is with Glenn Whelan, but he has to play.
Yeah. Oh, he has to. For him to be considered for starting in the game against Slovakia, he has to be playing games of football. He can't be just training on his own or not with a team. He has to be with a team. And even if he's at a team and he's not playing, will he still start? That's the question. You know, I know he's professional. I know he works hard. I know Glenn since I was 12 years of age. We played for Dublin and Ireland all the way up. So I know his character, his mentality. But you're talking about a massive game in Irish football. And, yeah, you know, you can't rely on someone's own ability to train. He needs to be with a club and playing.
Before we get into Spurs, what was it for you? Was it a slow creeping up or was it a cliff?
It was just off the edge, yeah. No. The cliff was my Achilles tendon, basically. Rupture, and that was kind of it. Like, really, I had options to go to the teams, and then when that happened, that was kind of it. It just put an end to it. I got back training slowly and got back fit, but not to the levels I would have been happy with. So that was the end of it, really.
Achilles tendon is a killer injury. It takes about a year to get back, and even then, your first year back, you're not good compared to what you could be.
And I think, I suppose, getting early on in your career, you can recover better from it. But I got mine now. I was 34, going on 35.
Yeah, so it's older than 2 years, really.
So it's getting towards the age, and I just recovered from a ruptured medial knee ligament as well, and up until that point I'd never had any many serious injuries. I'd had a couple of breaks and little silly things and fingers and hands, but nothing in the leg region. So to have two back to back, I think that was kind of the end.
Your body was telling you something.
I think it was. And then, to be fair, I ended up went and played in the Lee Miller game, God rest his soul, and I actually ruptured my other Achilles in that game. So I think that said it all, that probably career was probably coming towards an end.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. Let's talk Tottenham. They're playing Liverpool this weekend. The first question I have around Jose Mourinho and Tottenham, having looked at the evidence so far, is why can't they defend?
They can't defend because the defenders they have, some of them aren't capable of defending that well, to be honest. Like, Vertonghen and Alderweireld are very good defenders and have been steady for them through most of their time there, and him signing a new contract was excellent. But when you look at Serge Aurier, he was, on paper, he ticks every box. He's an athlete, he's strong, he's quick, he gets up and down well. But then he's just capable of making crazy decisions in the wrong time, and you need for your fullbacks to be consistent, and that's what he's lacking, really. So in that fullback area, the left back slot has been, again, playing Vertonghen there is not really the answer. He's not the quickest in that position. Don't get me wrong, he does a decent job, but he's not fantastic at being one-on-one situations and covering. He's better off being centre. And then you've got Sessegnon, who is a young, who's playing left wing, who I think eventually will play left back for them, but I don't think he feels like he's ready for that yet. So Danny Rose is on the periphery. He's been injured a bit and not ready. So I think fullback area is hugely crucial for them. And the goalkeeper, who I felt was really steady and good until he went and, like, Eric Cantona had in the game against Chelsea, and that craziness which came out, which I didn't expect at all from him, because he seemed very steady-handed and just, like, almost, I felt, Lloris wasn't going to get his position back, basically, on how well he performed. And so for me, they've just been lacking in all departments and consistency, and as a team, they've just not been cohesive enough. And Mourinho, wants teams that defend well. Like his main thing is to get his team set up defensively and then go to attack. And you know,
he make them defend well? Like, I mean, like, should we not be expecting a greater result than the sum of their parts from Jose Mourinho? Like, he's always at the very least been able to park the bus effectively.
Yeah, I think this is the problem with Tottenham. He hasn't wanted to park the bus so much with them. I think that's the issue. He's gone in there and he hasn't wanted to completely change their style of play. They've been known for being attack minded and go forward and have players that like to run off the ball, and he hasn't wanted to change that too much. I don't think he's wanted to go in and upset the apple cart really, because he didn't want people to think that Mourinho's got, I don't know, maybe this is my vision of it, but he didn't want people to have that perspective of him, that he's going to come in and just completely change how they play and get them set up defensively minded and then nick a win and nick draws, because that's not what he wanted to be seen as. But that might happen now because they've been conceding so many goals.
That's interesting. So it's almost Jose's heightened awareness of people's perception of him that is informing his new philosophy of football.
Or that he wanted to change, right? That actually the right thing to do is to change and evolve, because he's not stupid.
No, I think as well, like I said, when he took the job first, and like I said, I was gutted with Pochettino because it just happened so quickly and there was no real grieving time between when Mourinho took over, so you couldn't get your head around it. But then when he came in, I thought, you know what? And I said it here before, if we got the Mourinho that took over Chelsea back in the day when he first came over, you'd all be saying, like, every player I know that played for him would have died for him on the pitch. They loved him. They loved the way he played. I played against those teams. They were horrible to play against. Mm-hmm. They were so attack-minded, defensively solid, just great, great sides. And, you know, if that Mourinho came into Tottenham, you'd be delighted because he has that way of getting the best out of players. I'm just not too sure.
That was his peak, though.
That
team was amazing. He fixed any of the deficiencies that that team had, and they added such great characters. Like, having Drogba lead the line with Lampard and Terry. Yeah. And Cech, it's like this spine of just hard and aggressive, and they don't have that at the moment at Spurs. Like, Kane's gone off injured, and I don't know how long he's going to be out for. But the team that played at the weekend against Southampton was a good team. Like, it was a really good team.
It was, they were a good side. Yeah, they just it's so hard to pinpoint what is the issue with them. But I do feel that defensively they need to, like, Trippier going was crazy for me. I thought, I know that was under Pochettino, but I just felt, even though he wasn't having a great season, he was still arguably just behind Alexander Arnold, probably being the best fullback in the league. And then not replacing him, the midfield situation, Winks, I really like Harry Winks. I'm not too sure where he hasn't featured as much under Mourinho. I know he probably had a slight knock at when he came in first, but again, I think he's a very good player. And
apparently Winks doesn't know himself why exactly that is, and this is something that's been reported on in recent days, that there has been this culture of people who are out of favour not knowing why they're out of favour under Jose.
Well, that will create an issue, because if the manager's got, when he comes in initially, he's going to want to pick the team he feels best fits what he wants to play and how he wants to get his team set up. And, you know, he doesn't have to explain to those players, because he doesn't really owe anything to him when he first comes in. But if you want to keep them on side, explanation is important. And that's what you see Klopp and all these managers now do, that every single player that plays for them wants to play for them. Even if you're on the fringes, the interview he's had with Adam Lallana, like, he just wanted to play there. He wants to stay there. I know, obviously, that Liverpool are currently probably the best team in the world at the moment, but he just was happy to play any games when we got, and that comes from the manager. The manager can create that sense of, you know, even if you're not playing, you're still important to me. I'm still going to need you, and he still gets performances out of him.
Where would Harry Winks fit into this team at the minute? So to go back to the last league game, obviously the Southampton game. So it's Ndombele and Sissoko started in centre mid behind Eriksen, Ali, Dele Alli, and Lucas Moura. Who's he replacing, and what's his role?
Winks instead of Ndombele, I think. For me, that's where I see him. Kind of, he's more of a deeper midfield player than he can play that role. And for England, they think they tried him in the 10. He actually looked quite good, but in that role where he links the midfield and the attack and links the defense with the midfield, that's important for him. And he's always looking at the ball. The Champions League game, the final, was for me one of his best performances, and I thought he was excellent. But he's always looking for it. He can be a bit rash at times, dives in, but, you know, for the most part, I think he tries to do things right, and he looks forward with the ball as well. So I think him and Sissoko in the midfield would be a nice pairing, I think,
Okay, and I guess this comes back to what is the personality, what is the philosophy of this Spurs team under Mourinho? I don't think we've seen that just yet. I don't think there's been enough games. Like, is he a hybrid between what he was at Manchester United, But because he's got attacking players, is he actually a bit closer to the identity of the Chelsea team?
I actually think he's just in the, he's in between, isn't he? He wants to sort defensively out quite badly, and he makes comments about it all the time. Like every interview you see, he's saying, you know, defensively, and the first clean sheet he had, you could see how pleased he was that they kept the clean sheet. So that's something that he's going to want to address straight away. But I think he knows that if he can sort that out, that attacking wise, that they have got such good options. And players that are, that when Kane gets back fit and hopefully he's not out for too long, they will be in form and they link up together really well. And, you know, the quote about who is this, is this, is this Dele Alli or Dele Alli's brother, you know, those things. He knows that these players can be really influential on them. Eriksen, for me, has been probably the one player that is such a shame. I honestly spoke about it here as well, that he's been instrumental in everything Tottenham have done well for the last 5-6 years. And losing him and him not being in form has totally impacted the way they play. Like, absolutely, there's no doubt in my mind that if Eriksen was playing well, Tottenham would be playing better.
Can I ask you a question about that, right? If you're Christian Eriksen and your form's not good now, are you not costing yourself millions and millions and millions?
You would think you are, but I suppose with his age and with what he's done before, teams will still pay.
Will they?
I think they will.
I would definitely. If I was Man United, I'd be like,
offer him less.
Well, I just want to make sure you're still the player you used to be, as opposed to that was your peak 2 years ago and your peak is gone and I'm paying for that, but I'm going to get what you're currently doing.
Yeah, it's a completely valid argument to say, why would we, for this last season, the Premiership, the whole thing is, or the old saying is, you're only as good as your last game. And if you're going off Christian Eriksen, his last good game was probably last season at some point. But is he still capable of doing it? I think he is. I would agree.
I'd say he probably, more than likely, 90% he's capable of doing it. But if I'm the chief executive or the negotiator signing a deal with him where I'm committing like 40 million to him over 5 years or 4 years, I'd be like, could I just see some more of that? Just prove it to me one last time.
On trial for a week.
This doesn't happen in football, though. No. Like in American sports, if you're in a contract year, you put your best year in and you blitz it and everybody goes, well, that's contract year. Got to be careful not to pay him for that, because I'm not sure he's going to be, like, it doesn't happen in football. No. They down tools and they still get the deal.
Yeah, well, it's a funny sport, isn't it, in that sense, because you can't be cut from your contract, like in America, you can't just be cut mid-season or anything. So there's no, the players are have a lot more power in that sense. But for me, him as a player, I think he's still got what it takes. And he's shown glimpses of it. The Chelsea game on Stephen's Day. The couple of passes that he put in were, was it Chelsea game?
Southampton.
Southampton.
New Year's Day.
Stephen's Day, Southampton game, was it?
No.
Can't remember what game it was. On Stephen's Day.
Brighton, sorry.
For the goal, with Dele Alli scored, he hit a pass out wide, get recycled back to him, and hit another diagonal ball into Aurier, he set back. But the two passes were just exquisite, and I'm looking, going, oh, if you could get that for the whole time from him, then he'd be so much more valuable to Tottenham. But, you know, you never know. Manu or someone, whoever comes and signs him, could offer him a contract that's based around and say, you know, if you get the performance level up or we climb up the table based on what you've done, there could be some sort of bonus involved in the structure to try and get him back involved, like get him motivated more. But, you know, you feel the motivation for him is going to be just playing at a different club, because that's where his mind is at the moment.
Just one last thing on Spurs, and it's kind of a more general football point, is that when we talk about the defensive woes, Davinson Sanchez and his absence has been something that's been mentioned. And the one thing that Sanchez has that Vertonghen and Alderweireld don't have, or they certainly lost, is pace. And it's always a thing that's been mentioned. Like, you read Michael Obafemi speaking in the Mail this morning, talking about potentially like the times he was running as a kid. And every single new talent that comes on the scene, it's like, he's got pace, he can make it. Is it the single most important attribute for any player of any position, really, in the Premier League at the moment?
Yeah.
If you're not fast, you're not going to make it.
I think having pace is a huge advantage. There are players that are technically good enough that will still make it because they're so good and talented on the ball.
Christian Eriksen, as we've just been speaking
about. But pace, if you're playing full-back, wing, centre-back, centre-forward, all those positions, every position, if you've got pace about you, it benefited me in my career. I was quick enough, and so I ended up being pushed out to full-back because they felt I could do it on the right side. But it is hugely important, and everybody now is an athlete. There's no players anymore that like carry a bit of timber or get around. That you just, everybody is an absolute athlete, and they can perform at high levels repeatedly over and over again. And pace is a huge attribute. And there's so many people that are quick that if you're not quick, then you're gonna fall by the wayside, especially as a defender.
It was the coulda, shoulda, woulda derby last night for the Republic of Ireland between Jack Grealish and James Maddison.
I know, yeah.
Great heritage, you could see it. Like, if you had to, like, I think it's been a bit of a meme at the moment in the United Kingdom between the two players. It's kind of look alike, actually. Yeah, they're pictured in Benidorm or somewhere together there recently. If you had to pick one of them, and if you've got a blank checkbook at the moment, say if you're Manchester United, I think, or perhaps even Spurs, who are you going for?
Based on my personal experience with Jack, I was, when I came back from my Achilles injury, I trained Aston Villa for like 8 months, a year almost, with Steve Bruce, the year they got beaten in the playoff final. And he is exceptional. Like, exceptional footballer. Like, really, really is such a talent. And Maddison, I've watched quite closely, and I think he's probably been a bit more consistent in the Premier League level for a while now, and he's done really well. But for just talent, Grealish was just out of this world, I have to admit. He's just such a good footballer. Like, everything about his game, and I think he's matured. When I was there, Steve Bruce was really trying to get that side of him. He was trying to, listen, put a bit more pressure on him to perform weekly, week in, week out, and tell him that he was important to the club, and, you know, the nonsense that, you know, his lifestyle and all that stuff had to change, and that was really important for Steve Bruce, and you could see he was trying to implement that. And then when Dean Smith came along, you know, giving him the armband, really kind of put on his shoulders. So, but I think he is an exceptional talent and could play in any team in the Premier League.
Could they play together?
Probably, yeah. I think they probably could.
So, like, if you're the England coach, stick them in the team, see what happens, right?
Yeah, it's like, there's no... Why he hasn't got a cap now is kind of crazy. I'm not too sure why you wouldn't have given him one at this point. Like, you've watched him enough times to not cap him. But then you have Maddison, who's been performing well, and he's only got his one cap, I think, is it two? So two caps, maybe. So, you know, it's a plethora of talent in the number 10 area, and it just depends on whether you want to play number 10 or not, doesn't it? If you want to play that position, if you want to have that free role. The only issue I have with Jack Grealish is that when he plays for Villa, he often drops way too deep, and you're totally losing out on what he offers. You see him when he's not in the game, he tries to get on the ball too much, and you see he drops back into areas where he's not as effective. So when he comes back in deep midfield and starts to pass off, and you don't want him there. You want him higher up the pitch. You want him receiving the ball, turning in pockets and finding, you know, little areas and trying to put people through. But, you know, he's done exceptionally well in the Villa team to have not really been performing. So what would he be like in a team that are better players around
him? Yeah, you could see him doing really well at, as you say, any team. But, like, he'd be great in Old Trafford. He'd be great at Arsenal. He'd be great.
Yeah.
Would City have a different role from...
Possibly, yeah. See, I think City are just different in the way they play. They're and Liverpool as well, with their wings are predominantly the way they kind of operate. But if you're looking for a man in the middle to get on the ball and turn and create something, you know, you can't really look past either of those players.
All right, Stephen's staying with us. It's 4 minutes past nine this morning. It's time for Deal or No Deal.
I signed for them after the Euros, and after my first day's training, I was driving home. I was actually thinking,
regretting it.
What have I done? Like, I walked into a circus.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, Deal or No Deal. First, we want your thoughts on some running Spurs stories, Stephen. Christian Eriksen could be on the way to Inter for £20 million before his contract expires. Manchester United also linked with the Dane. Was it a mistake in retrospect to keep him last summer and not cash in? And can Spurs do without him?
I think it's shown this season that they can't really do without him because how poorly they performed. But they're going to have to. So deal with it. I think they should have sold him sooner, so they would have got more money from him. It was a bad decision not to try and cash in on him and get as much as you possibly could, because if a player is that adamant that they're going and you can't change their mind, then you got to just take the money.
Yeah, so if you're him though, you sit it out now.
You sit out, yeah. There's no point. Like, you know, and I'm sure his boys are going to be telling him, listen, you're probably, that whatever they're going to, that fee they're going to pay for you, you're going to get in your bank balance yourself, so don't worry about it.
Sit tight. Yeah. On Monday, we brought everybody the news that Manchester United and Man City are reported to be interested in Harry Winks, who's been a bit part player so far under Mourinho. The Athletic say that Winks has been left in the dark regarding Jose's plans for him. Just how good is he, and will Spurs miss him?
Yeah, like I said, I think he's very good. I like the way he plays. I like his intensity. I like the way he gets on the ball. He's young as well, so he's got a lot more about him. A lot more to come, and, you know, I think there'd be a big loss if Tottenham were to lose him. But he hasn't played really under Mourinho, so he doesn't seem like he's in his pants.
Spurs fans are going to feel like him the way Chelsea fans feel about Mo Salah and Kevin De Bruyne.
Yeah.
we should have those guys on our team. The way Villa fans feel about Adama Traore. We're hearing Troy Parrott is locked in talks to sign a major new deal with Spurs amid chatter of interest from the likes of Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund. Here's a reminder of Jose's comments about the 17 going an 18-year-old last week. Next step is for him to sign a new contract in the long term, because at this club we care about our young players. The age of 17, I don't think it's good to go on loan to the Championship or another country. At 17, you're a baby. You need to be with your father club. Minutes will arrive, but step by step, not in a situation where you are straight away the replacement for Kane. What's best for Troy Parrott? Should he be concerned about lack of playing time this season as he sits between the reserves and match day first team squads?
It is very difficult, because he's going to want to stay there as to be as close to the manager, so you've seen him week in, week out, so you can prove to him. But if you're like the weekend, he wasn't first choice replacement for Kane, and we know that's not the case. You know that the manager are probably going to play Son or more ahead of him, and then if they're looking to bring in another striker as well, then how far down the pecking order do you go? At 17, I don't think his age is really relevant because of the physical attributes he has and the type of player he is. I think that's null and void because of the type of player he is and the way he's shown he can play kind of men's football. So for me, game time is going to be really important for his development.
If Borussia Dortmund are interested in you, you're obviously within your rights to go, can I play? Am I going to get some first team action? Yeah. Like, how close to the first team am I here? They've obviously just signed Haaland, so not that close. But a year, 2 years at Dortmund has done the world of good for countless careers in football over the last two decades. Yeah. Not the worst idea to think about it, is it?
No, it's absolutely not. And to go over there and play Champions League football, probably, and you know, it's a different style of football, and you're learning from different ways. But you know, everybody that's gone there, a lot of players have gone there. Look at Sancho; like he's talked about being a 120 million player now. You know, so
should his agent not be kind of like bringing up Bundesliga teams? Like, I mean, is Bayern Munich and Dortmund just like, because they're playing Champions League football, it's just a little bit out of reach at the moment to actually get meaningful minutes. As you mentioned, they can bring the checkbook out and sign the top scorer in the Champions League. So perhaps to like look at, should he not be picking up the phone to Hertha Berlin, to Jurgen Klinsmann, and saying, listen, would you take our young Irish boy under your wing, or somebody lower down Bundesliga? Because it's not going to harm him, really, because he seems like a confident guy. He's not going
to
be...
You don't want to go to a basket case club either, though.
No. I think for him, just going somewhere and playing regular football is all that matters, really. It doesn't... You know, obviously the level is going to be very important, and if you can get Champions League to him, that's amazing. But you know, even if there was a decent top end Championship team that was pushing for promotion, like, for him to go and experience that level of football, like the intensity of it, you know, you get used to playing matches week in, week out. That's the thing.
He's not even playing under 23 at the minute, because he's too good for it. So that was what Keith Andrews was talking about during the week as well. Wilfried Zaha being linked with Spurs, and it's going to go for a massive fee when he leaves Crystal Palace. Does this sound like paper talk? Could you see that deal happening?
I'm not sure. Like, if that's really what Tottenham will do, really. Like, don't get me wrong, I think he definitely improved them. He's a very good player, and he's a player that you can, if things aren't going wrong, you can give him the ball, and you know that he makes things happen. He's been absolutely pivotal in Crystal Palace and how well they've done. And would he improve Tottenham? Yeah, he definitely would. He's a fantastic footballer. Will Tottenham go out of their way to spend so much money on him? Probably not.
Yeah.
Like, Bayern Munich were in for him for a potential loan move, which I believe reports over the last couple of days as well, for Wilfried Zaha. Like, have people, has the Zaha boat not sailed? Like, was last summer not like
the summer was
the time to get him? Like, is there not a case where there's a guy who clearly doesn't want to be at the club, his enthusiasm, okay, maybe that's a bit strong, that he clearly doesn't want to be at the club, because he stuck by them and he played really well last season, for example. Like, 3 goals, I think, this season it's not the worst return in the world. But, like, surely his enthusiasm is going to start waning, and as a result, his the actual value he would have for his next club, really.
Well, that's just the point we're making with Christian Eriksen. Do people still feel that he can get the Wilfried Zaha that scape? And the thing is, he's younger. He's probably got a bit more.
He's got age on his side, no question about that.
So I think people won't be worried about that,
Are Spurs going to qualify for the Champions League? Mourinho's saying he's not going to sign anybody even after Moussa Sissoko's injury.
I was very optimistic that they were going to qualify for the Champions League, and now I'm like, oh, I don't know.
6 points off Chelsea and loads of games left.
I think the Chelsea game is huge. When they lost to them, I just felt like, oh, it was an opportunity. And I know Lampard set the team up very well and stifled them, but Tottenham didn't have any answers. They can do it. They're definitely capable of doing it.
A Spurs-related question, but it's actually a Man United question. Should Manchester United just now sack Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and bring in Pochettino before somebody else gets him?
Probably.
This will be the third time this happened.
Yeah.
They didn't get Pep when they should have. Didn't even try and get Klopp when they should have. Now Pochettino's out there, you're like, come on.
just for his, like I said, he's still not won anything, and for Pochettino going into Manchester United, the expectancy level for him to win something is going to be extremely high. So for him as a manager, I think getting a job that would almost guarantee him a trophy would be better for him. Just for him to get that off his back and be like, right now I'm a proven winner, now I can go and show you that I can just go and win trophies. But he was going to turn down Manchester United to come calling, and I think if they don't take the opportunity to take him now, there will be other offers on the table for him. I'm sure he's had offers already.
On a point of information, just back to your Zaha take, comparing to Eriksen, go through with this, follow it through, don't even let the age thing get you down. Like, I mean, the 27 club has been something that's featured quite a bit in this transfer market. Well. Jesse Lingard, Christian Eriksen, Wilfred Zaha, all 27, all 27 years old.
Right. I thought he was 20.
Who would have thought that? Like that?
I thought Zaha was younger.
Been around for a while, I guess. Yeah. Right.
Good take.
Yeah.
The Mail say that former Juve boss Allegri is sitting on the sidelines in the hope of landing the Manchester United job, so we're going to monitor that one. Let's move on. Samuel Umtiti, El Desmarque in Spain, report that Spurs, Arsenal and Manchester United are trying to sign the centre-back Samuel Umtiti, 26, from Barcelona. What impact would he make in the Premier League? Is he good enough?
Yeah, I think he's a good player. I think he's, for France, he's been very well for them, hasn't he? You've watched the games, and he's got pace, which we just spoke about, which is extremely important. Consistency levels, sometimes you're a little bit...
Yeah, but he's played a lot of games.
He's played loads of games, yeah. And, you know, to say that he couldn't come in and improve on those teams or be better than what they already have, I'd say definitely, because at the moment, a lot of top four teams defensively, they're struggling, aren't they, with their centre-backs and the players that they would need to rely on and build a team around. And, you know, at his age, you could definitely come in and do a job.
Exactly. And at 26, you would hope, I was just about to say, that over the next 3 or 4 years, there's a guile that comes with the experience of playing centre-back, that he actually just gets a bit better. How good is Ashley Young at this age of his career? He's 34. We brought the news yesterday that he could be on his way to Inter willing to spend some money, get him out.
Yeah, I'm not sure he poses much of a benefit to Manchester United anymore. I think he's there, and what position would he play? I know he often plays left back for them, and you know he's used sporadically throughout the season in different places. He's still a talented footballer. I think he gets a lot of flack based on what really, you know, I mean, when I played against Ashley and he was an out and out left winger, he was a difficult player to play against, like, because he would go both ways, left foot, right foot, and he put in a very good delivery of the ball. So, but that's changed for him now, and since he's been turned into a left back, his role in the club and the football changed. And I don't think he's as good a left back as what's out there. So for me, for him, probably time to move on.
We were kind of floating the idea yesterday with Phil that potentially he has kind of a Chris Smalling sort of bump if he goes to Italy. Could you see that happening?
Yeah, I think I absolutely. Get like an Indian summer, just kind of come along and have a... I think Chris Smalling left Manchester United, and because it's been so dour and downtrodden there, you can't help but be lifted, unless you go into a club that's equally as bad and, you know, negative around surrounding you, which I don't think it would be the case if he goes to Italy, and getting away from, you know, the bubble that is Manchester. It's only going to benefit him mentally, I would have thought.
We talked about Jack Grealish a little bit earlier on, but Neil Warnock has been singing his praises over in TalkSport. I think he's a horrible little so-and-so when you're playing against him, because you know as soon as somebody breathes on him, he's going to go down. Shut up, Neil. But his ability is fantastic. If Villa go down, I think he's good enough to be a Man United player. He's that kind of player. Like how Cantona played for Man United, I think he would strut his business there. Would it be a mistake for Jack Grealish to go to Manchester United in the summer?
It's so weird how the way we're talking about Manchester United now is like any young potential player that's decent, is it a risk going to Manchester United? It's a crazy conversation to be having, isn't it? You're thinking many years ago was that like every player be biting your hand off, like, and people are trying to say staying at Aston Villa or staying at Leicester is also a better option going to Manchester United. I still don't think it is a better option than going to Manchester United, realistically. Like, it's still one of the biggest clubs in the world. Arguably, they're not performing well, but you would feel with their finances and with what they have.
Look, it's a money thing. It is a money thing. They could double his. Yeah. Villa could make him their highest paid player, and Man United could double it, and he still wouldn't be their biggest paid player.
But Villa don't have the potential to go in and buy enough players to win the league. Manchester United do.
The only thing is, when was the last time somebody signed for Man United and everybody went, you're doing really well there now. Yeah. You've improved as a footballer. You're a better... We rate you maybe Daniel James?
Daniel James is the only one, I think, that you've said has gone there, and it's only because people didn't expect him to play.
Martial?
He started
there a long time now.
Yeah.
Like on that Grealish point from Warnock, okay, like he perhaps goes over easy a little bit more, but like I don't know, is that like a bit lazy a way to kind of talk about Grealish? The first thing that comes to mind, he's captain of the club at 24. He's playing like a man who's been around for way longer than his years would suggest. Like it's baffling, as we've already kind of mentioned, that he hasn't played for England already at this point. Like I think Jack Grealish's hallmark is his maturity and his steel and his grit, and that's what he brings, rather than flimsy breathing him and he goes down.
Yeah, and I think how his mentality has got so much stronger, and he's become such more a mature player in the last few years. And like I said, no more evident than things to me give the armband, and he really has taken that on too much at times, I think, because like I said, I don't like him dropping deep. I prefer him staying high up the pitch because it's where he's more effective. But you know, when you're Jack Grealish, every time you get the ball, if you're Aston Villa's biggest threat, every time you get the ball, someone's going to try and tackle you or kick you or pull you down. So let's face it, you're going to be under pressure by everybody, because you're the only one they're going to try and stop from playing.
Would you go to Spurs?
It would be excellent at Spurs. I felt last year...
They were linked with him, weren't
and
they?
And I felt... Because Tottenham are always good at getting younger players, and I thought that would be an amazing one for him.
Yeah. All right, last one. A quick update from Germany. We talked about Mario Götze at the Liverpool rumours yesterday. We gave them a low legitimacy rating. However, Mario Götze does not agree. He's been speaking with DAZN. He says, I'm still in touch with Jürgen. He taught me everything about professional football. He let me play. I often speak to Klopp. We never stop talking. He knows me very well, and I am always looking for new challenges. Mario Götze issues, come and get me, please.
Yeah, I think it's done that buttering Klopp up just to try and, he's a mate of mine, come and add me to something. Don't get me wrong. I think when he came onto the scene, he was fantastic footballer, but it's gone downhill since. A lot of bad injuries, and he's just not been able to achieve the levels you would expect. Will he go to Liverpool? I'm not sure what I can see that happening.
It's not your typical Liverpool signing. It's not maybe it is. It's free, right? Yeah, so you pay his salary, you give him a 2-year deal, and if he's any good, you renew it.
It's interesting that they're on the phone to each other quite a bit. Like, I wonder, is he thinking about his football philosophy when he's talking to Jurgen Klopp? A potential future disciple, future assistant coach?
Yeah, possibly. Like I said, I think some managers, they do, if they've had a player from a younger age, which Klopp had him at Dortmund, he probably sees him as being his mentor, and that's the person he relies on and would go to for information stuff.
It would be a big ego trip for Klopp to get him back to the level that he was at when he was 19, 20, 21 as well.
Oh yeah, so as a little side project for Klopp, just to see what he can, if he's capable of getting a single, that could be interesting.
Yeah, all right. Stephen, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. That's it for Deal or No Deal this Thursday morning. We're back talking Joey Carberry and Tom Brady next. OTB
AM. He's obviously made a brave decision moving club. A lot of it was set up from in Leinster, I suppose, but then the big thing for him was getting game time in the number 10 jersey, and it just hasn't happened. And obviously the World Cup was hugely disappointing, and the fact with his own ankle injury, and then coming back, you thought that he did everything possible to get it right, which it seemed to be, and then Sod's law prevails and you snap something in your wrist, which sounds interesting. It's a ligament injury in the wrist which requires surgery, so it sounds complicated. Sounds nasty.
Yeah, and it must be so frustrating for him, because there's no trend to these injuries. Like, anyone can go over on their ankle. I don't know how his wrist injury happened, but presumably he just got it caught awkwardly somewhere. It's not like it's down to a lack of preparation or a lack of condition. This is just
no, exactly. It seems to be very fast, which, if I were a thoroughbred horse, probably gets injured a little bit more frequently than other guys, because he's so highly strong, I think, and he is a serious athlete, I suppose. Maybe he could easily maybe snap defending some guy in training, but that's only speculation. But it's bad news from bad news, hugely bad news for Munster, and obviously for Ireland as well, because I think going forward it is his time. He has time to respond, but when you're a number 10, you are very impatient, and certainly it's going to be the case for him. It's not a great month to get injured, January, February, March, because as a test athlete, that's when you want to play.
Right, a recap of the top five stories this morning, 20 minutes past nine for you here on OTB AM. Declan Bonner talking about not being able to field a team for Donegal in the McKenna Cup, given that so many of his players are actually under duress because of the Sigerson Cup and other commitments that they have at the moment. We were talking about that earlier on, how it might actually be the best thing for the future of Gaelic football if he doesn't actually put a team in. Jack McCaffrey was in talking about a wide range of things, the end of the Jim Gavin era, the start of the Desi Farrell era, the advanced mark, and a few more bits and pieces as well. The return of Stephen Cluxton, he thinks, that Cluxton's gung-ho and ready to come back. The FAI directors, we now know the identity of two of the independent directors and the new independent chair as well. Shane Ross has been on Newstalk Breakfast in the last half hour talking in some detail about this. He doesn't anticipate giving any money to the FAI without conditions. He's happy that these appointments have been made and says that we're now in a new chapter. It's not about giving the FAI money, it's about being certain that the League of Ireland, schoolboy and grassroots sectors of Irish football thrive. UEFA will be here next week. He's going to meet with the FAI and the Bank of Ireland and government to see if everybody combined can combine to save football. So Shane Ross taking the penalty kick this morning, happy as Larry with his own commitment, his own performance throughout all this, when you know you bear in mind that he's been the Minister of Sport for the whole time when all this has gone on. So anyway, the other two stories that we haven't really covered. Joey Carberry, just heard there from Ronan O'Gara talking about the Joey Carberry injury. He's out for between 2 and 4 months. And then Tom Brady and his future, he took to Instagram to have a slightly long post. We'll start with Carberry. Want to talk a bit about Joey Carberry?
Revealed yesterday that he's going to be out for up to 4 months. Like 2 to 4 months, they do say. So somebody of his age, perhaps it's going to be a bit quicker. So you're talking May. Pro 14 season doesn't end till middle, end of May. So he'll don the red shirt a Munster before the end of the season and then gear up for the summer. And like, I think you're probably of more of a sunny disposition than I was at the start of the week about this injury. Like, I'd certainly be looking at it initially glass half empty. It's like, what a lost year it's been for Joey Carberry, whereas you were kind of making the point that he's still young and that, you know, once these things start to settle down, we can start to finally see him in full flow.
Yeah, look, you don't wish these injuries on anybody. And you see, even Robbie Henshaw has had a very injury-plagued career since he came to Leinster, and we haven't had the opportunity to see him have 18 months, 2 years unbroken. But the stresses that rugby places on the body is fairly unique. You get contact injuries, you get long-form running injuries, you get impact injuries, you get twisting and turning. Like, they have these weird bodies that are both athletic and powerful, and they need to be able to do distances and they need to be explosive at the same time. So
it exposes you to a whole range of possible injuries.
Yeah, and like, you just hope that he gets a run where these types of injuries, which aren't luckily enough linked. Like, if this was one thing the whole time that he kept failing and kept failing and kept failing, you'd really feel like, ooh, this doesn't bode well. But the fact that they're all very different suggests that it's just a series of bad luck. And you hope that that bad luck, you know, on a statistical analysis, he'd be a candidate for regression in terms of days spent absent. It would be like, well, he's wasted up all his bad luck, you hope. And so there is a couple of seasons coming. From April, where his body just goes, okay, I'm ready for this now.
Yeah, he's also, like, I think as well, he released kind of a statement through his own social media channels the other day when it initially happened. Like, he's probably got to a point, unfortunately, where he knows how to deal with this stuff a little bit better. He knows what to do to keep himself busy over the next 2 to 4 months and what sort of mindset he should be in. Just hope it doesn't grind him down over time. And I think everybody kind of realises what an exceptional talent he is. Nobody is really talking about him kind of falling out of favour or not getting the 10 jersey back from Munster when he comes back. He's just the automatic choice whenever he's fit. There is a gulf between him and the rest. Like, even in like, it would have been interesting if he did hang around at Leinster and you get into the post-Sexton era. Would Ross Byrne then be now the candidate and it would be up for an injury-free Joey Carberry to displace him? Because obviously Munster wouldn't have anybody as talented as Ross Byrne in their ranks at the moment. So that would perhaps have been an interesting dynamic, and that will become the talking point once Sexton does walk away from Ireland about Carberry versus Byrne, unless there is another bolter that we haven't spoken about yet.
Ben Healy. You know, look, who knows? Who knows? I think Ben Healy's going to have a big game this weekend. That's my wild prediction. I hope he's going to have a big game. Really very excited about seeing him if they pick him. Mm. It's like, look, come on, this is it.
I would certainly suggest he's not going to do anything wrong. That would be my prediction, because there's a chance he might not play at all.
Well, that's no good.
It would be a better prediction anyway. But yeah, so that's that. Tom Brady's the other story he wanted to come back to this morning.
Yeah, this is the Shakespearean drama unfolding, the love triangle between himself, who is obviously the greatest quarterback ever to play the game, the head coach, Bill Belichick, who's the greatest coach ever, and Robert Kraft, who loves himself some Tom Brady. Tom Brady took to Instagram yesterday, big long post.
My favourite part of it is that he says, every one of us that works at Gillette Stadium strives to do their best, spent themselves at a worthy cause and prepare to fail while daring greatly, hat tip Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
For fear he doesn't tip us that. We've been rewarded with something that the scoreboard won't show, the satisfaction of knowing we gave everything to each other in pursuit of a common goal. That seems like a very un-Tom Brady thing to say, that if you're not winning, you're at nothing, really, is how I always perceive Tom Brady to be. And it's clearly after the dust has settled here, he's getting a bit more wistful about the season that was.
Yeah,
I guess it's an achievement for a 40-something-year-old man to be quarterback in a team that makes the playoffs. In
42 and 43 next year by the time training camp starts. So in both life and football, failure is inevitable. You don't always win. You can, however, learn from that failure. Pick yourself up with great enthusiasm and place yourself in the arena again. And that's right where you'll find me, because I know I still have more to prove.
Has there been a massive overreaction to the Patriots last weekend? And to Tom Brady in particular? Like, as I say, you're still a playoffs team. You can't win the Super Bowl every year. It's not like the Patriots won every Super Bowl under Brady and Belichick. What is it, six? Six Super Bowls? It's insane. That's an incredible record.
Yeah.
You've been playing there for 20 years.
Yeah.
And so it's six out of 20.
Has there been an overreaction? No, because this is the greatest player on a team with the greatest coach. And it looks like they're headed for divorce. It's more likely than not
that they won't get divorced.
Well, it's not really. It's actually more likely that something mad is going to happen where the owner has to step in and pay him too much money and piss off Bill Belichick. So the reason they were no good this year was because they had no one to throw the ball to. Mm. They had no tight ends, and all their wide receivers got suspended, went crazy, or were injured or no good. Mm-hmm. And it was a strange concatenation of events, this bizarre sequence where every single thing they tried failed.
Yeah.
So to make that thing better next year, they need money. They're going to have to pay him the money. He's always not got paid enough money. He always took a hometown discount.
To win.
Which led to people speculating that he was somehow going to be rewarded by Robert Kraft at the end of his career with like some business thing. A bit like Saracens. So essentially, the thing was, like, there's no way Tom Brady is not the best paid player in football, because he's the best player in football. He should be the best paid. And he's never been the best paid quarterback or the best paid player. Now it's getting to the point where Brady's like, I want to get paid. You've got to pay me for all the stuff that I've done. And he deserves to get paid a ridiculous amount of money. So if they're going to do that, they won't be able to afford to buy the players from to throw to. So Belichick's looking at that going, we're not going to win. This is the end of my career as well. I'm getting to the point where I have to retire because, like, I'm getting old. Right? So I want to win. My best chance of winning is building a team and getting another quarterback in, because I think any quarterback can win in my system. Brady's good. He's not that good. I'm the one. This is my team. That's what Bill Belichick thinks.
And is there not a situation where Tom Brady is having these conversations and saying to himself, okay, one more year of me getting paid a pittance, relative pittance. You go get the parts around me, but it's up to you now, Bobby Kraft and Billy Belichick, to actually make sure that these people that you get around me aren't complete screw-ups, and that you actually have...
Yeah.
Proper talent around me. I'll give you one more year, one more lease.
Maybe.
On my 43rd year, you can have that, Patriots.
That's the end of it, though. But he says he wants to play at least 45. So, like, why not go to LA and get 50 million, 60 million over 2 years? He's from San Francisco.
Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly.
He's not going to displace.
I think they have a giant. I think they have one of those giant super mansions in LA anyway. So, and he sold his house in Boston. So there's loads of stuff that suggests that actually his time in New England is coming to an end. And look, it's always good drama, and there's lots of speculation, and there's loads of different sides briefing against each other.
And it's going to get more media coverage than the Super Bowl itself over when we get to that point in the next few weeks.
Well, he's got
release an eve of a Super Bowl statement is what I say to Tom Brady announcing his.
Marshawn Lynch retired at halftime in the Super Bowl one time.
Actually, yeah.
Has made two subsequent comebacks since. Look, I don't think so. I think that Brady wants to, you know, this is negotiations. This is like, I want to stay. That statement seems like he wants to stay, right?
Yes.
Bob Kraft said yesterday to Peter King that he wants Brady to retire or to play with the Patriots. So the owner is saying, this is what I want. The player is saying, this is what I want. Belichick sitting
there.
He's
one more part in that.
His hood pulled up, sleeves cut off. Screw both of you. Mm. Like, maybe I'll leave.
And then they're in an interesting enough position. Like, it's the hiring of coaches hasn't exactly been a flawless science in the NFL over the last few years. In actual fact, it's probably more dependable. The new wave of quarterbacks is probably an easier thing to get right than new coaches, because there's been some basket cases of franchises as a result of the coaching appointments they've made.
Yeah. I don't know. That off-season, those narratives, we'll talk about those a good bit on The Snap, our new weekly American football show, and obviously we'll bring you up to date with it here on OTB AM as well. But if you're, now's a good time to get into the NFL. The games are good, the Saturday night games, the Sunday games.
Bills are out, so don't bother.
These next few weeks are going to be fairly special. This weekend's slate of games are absolutely amazing. Last weekend's games were probably the best wildcard weekend ever. But this weekend,
the Saturday night makes it. Once college football is done and you can actually have Saturday night games, because you'd have it over Christmas as well, that's the time to get on board.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely is. And okay, so we're pretty much done here. It's 9:32 this morning here. Comments on the Ireland 23s. Owen's team's okay, but I have to disagree with Earl's time for a fresh number 11. How can you not have McCluskey at number 12, says El Poderoso. James Gill also says McCluskey in better form than Bundiaki. Earl's form has been relatively poor recently, so if you're selecting on form, don't make sense, says Dahi O'Shocknessig.
Makes a fair point that you could, if you're picking on form, I don't know though, I think you made a very valid point on that Earl tends to do the business. Like, if we're judging things on what happened in Japan, then Andrew Conway's stock rises quickly. Or if we're picking on recent club form, you could just install Will Addison as your fullback and put Jordan Larmour and Jacob Stockdale in the wings. That would be an exciting team.
Couple of things to watch out for at 10:15 this morning on the Pat Kenny Show. They've got a piece coming up on the next generation of Irish football. Dan McDonald of the Irish Indo, Stephen Henderson, head of youth development at Shelburne, and Robert Flanagan, the International Academy scout for West Ham, are all going to be chatting to Pat. Off the Ball, back on your radios tonight from 7 o'clock. You can subscribe to the OTB AM podcast, fully timestamped, to make it very easy to find exactly what you want from this morning's show. Top five stories this Thursday morning: Stephen Kelly on Spurs, Grealish and Deal or No Deal, our Ireland 23 for the Scotland game, and Vincent Wall on the newly appointed independent FAI director. Is a great explainer there. You'll find us on the podcast, also on YouTube. You can get us on your smart TV or Go Loud, the app where OTB Sports Radio is live and continuous. We're back tomorrow morning from 7:30. We're going to see you then. Alan Quinlan, Brendan Menton are on the show, and we're also going to be picking up our crystal ball to gaze forward to see what is going to happen in 2020. So you don't even have to pay any attention to what's going to happen in the sport, world of sport. We'll just tell you tomorrow morning. Stay tuned, 7:30. Good luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.